This is Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. James Bussey. It is Veterans Day, November 11th, 2002. We are in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Bussey, thanks for being here.
You're very, very welcome. I'm honored to be here, in fact.
Well, good, good. Let's start with some biographical information. Sure. Where were you born and when were you born?
I was born on October the 16th, 1942 in Childress, Texas.
Okay.
And I lived there or in the vicinity of there for my first 7 years.
So you grew up in Childress, basically for 7 years.
For 7 years, then I moved on from the High Plains, and I really grew up in Levelland.
Okay.
Due west of here.
Okay, in Levelland.
Yes, sir.
And did you spend the rest of your years there in Levelland and graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school there in 1961, and okay. Then I attended South Plains College for 2 years, completed my bachelor's degree at Texas Tech, and then okay. later on completed my master's in 1973, and I've done some postmaster's work at Tech and some postmaster's work at Wayland Baptist University also.
Okay, great, great. So tell me about, what do you remember about Childress growing up there?
I had my life as a child, even early child, was a very happy life. Mm-hmm. I had two very loving, supportive parents, mm-hmm. and my years, and I had a lot of friends in Childress. Mm-hmm. We were relatively poor.
Okay.
My dad was a cotton ginner and did some other things too. And my mother was a nurse, but in the early years of my life, she didn't work as a nurse because she wanted to raise her three children who were born one right after the other. And okay. so we were really relatively poor, but very happy.
Okay. Well, good.
It was a good environment. We lived in the poor side of town, actually.
Really?
And I've taken my wife and family over there, and they can't believe I lived in that. It's about the same as it did when I was back then now.
So your mother didn't work? She
Not until we moved to the High Plains when okay. I was about in the third grade.
Okay.
And then we were getting to the point where we wanted to be a little more affluent. Mm-hmm. My family did, uh-huh. and my parents did, and so my mom went back to work. She was an RN.
Okay.
And she quit work when I was born and did a little bit of private duty nursing, mm-hmm. but mostly she wanted to raise us.
Okay. Okay.
As long as she could.
Okay. What do you remember about the cotton gin industry?
I remember a lot about. I tell people I was raised in a cotton gin. I worked in cotton gin when I was about 11 years old, mm-hmm. and I worked in cotton gins until off and on until I graduated from college. I worked with my dad.
Okay.
And my dad was always happy to work for him. And some of my best memories are working with my father.
Really?
I admired and loved him very much, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed working with him in a cotton gin.
Okay.
However, I'm a little bit allergic to cotton.
Were you then allergic?
I was then too, yeah.
Oh boy, so it's a little bit
yeah.
tough for you.
It was a little bit tough, but I endured it.
So tell me about Levelland. You moved there when you were 7 years old?
We moved to Brownfield for a couple of years, then we were at La Mesa, and then uh-huh. we moved from La Mesa right before my fourth grade to uh-huh. Levelland.
Okay.
You know, and we stayed there. My dad was the sort of person who liked to move.
Okay.
And he would become angry with a boss or something like that, and he wanted to move. Well, we got together when we moved to Levelland and persuaded Dad, let's stay a little while longer. And he died there later on, you know, in the 1970s.
He stayed a while.
So he stayed there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I was raised in Levelland, and I love Levelland. It was an ideal place for a person at the time. In the late 50s and early 60s particularly.
Did you come to Lubbock often?
Yeah. Well, at that time we'd come at least about once a month or so. Mom liked to come over to your shop, and we liked mm-hmm. to go out to eat. My dad liked to eat out and go to movies.
Okay.
So we were over at Lubbock at least once a month. I live about 25, 30 miles away now, and we come about once a week, sometimes twice a week.
Okay.
And so we're a little more mobile perhaps than we were then.
Okay. All right.
But we were over here a lot.
Good. Tell me about Levelland. What do you remember about the town that was so fond of?
So I was so fond of the people. Were very friendly mm-hmm. and open people. They were. It was during the 50s, and you know, some of the stereotypical things you think of the 50s mm-hmm. were. Levelland was indicative of those things. It was a kind of a laid back era.
Mm-hmm.
It was a happy era. Things were calm. People didn't worry about a great deal. They didn't even worry about nuclear war, which sometimes we hear that they did during mm-hmm. that era, but we didn't.
Okay.
And they didn't either, and it was really a nice average lower middle class existence that I had.
Okay. Tell me about your high school years. What did you do in high school?
In high school, I did a lot of things. I liked Spanish, so I was in Spanish club. Mm-hmm. I was in student council. Mm-hmm. I was in tennis. I tried to be in football and kept injuring myself, so I got out of football pretty soon.
Okay.
But I was in track a little bit, but I liked Texas history. I had an advanced Texas history class. I was almost a fanatical Texas history person at that
really?
Time.
Okay.
I love Texas history, especially Sam Houston, Austin, those sorts of people.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Were you a good student?
I was a fair student. I wasn't as good as I could have been.
Okay.
I was having too much fun in life, actually, as was indicative of my first year in college.
Okay.
I had too much fun that year. Before I settled down and became a scholar, actually.
Okay.
Well, maybe a scholar.
Now, was education emphasized in your family? Was
it very much so.
Was it expected?
It was expected. My sisters and I were raised knowing that we were going to go to college.
Okay.
And so we didn't think of not going to college. We didn't think of not... in fact, I didn't think of not at least having a master's degree. And if my dad had lived he died in 76, he probably would have eventually persuaded me to try for a doctorate at least.
Right.
But they all believed, everyone in the family believed in education. My dad was basically had very little formal education. He had to quit school right after his eighth grade,
mm-hmm.
but he believed in education a great deal. His family got together during the Depression and put his youngest brother, through A&M.
Okay.
By raising money and striving to do that. And that was the one in the family who went to college.
Okay.
Dad couldn't even go to high school. And he always wanted to go to college, too. And Dad was a very intelligent person, but he was an unlettered person.
Okay.
But he wanted to be lettered.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you
have? I have two sisters. I have two sisters that are a little bit younger than I both.
Okay. So you were the oldest of the family?
I was the oldest. I was born in 42. I had a sister born in 44 and one in 45.
Okay. Now, when you graduated high school, Levelland, why Texas Tech?
A couple of reasons. First of all, I preferred Texas Tech, but we were so poor, I had to go there. I just lived 25 miles away.
So
it was close.
You lived at home?
Yeah, I lived at home. I never lived in a dorm. I lived at home, Community Tech.
Okay.
In fact, I've never lived in a dorm. The closest to a dorm was an Army barracks, you know. But I wanted to live in a dorm for a while until I found out what dorms were like, and I didn't want all that nonsense.
Now, what year was this when you went to Tech?
I went to Tech 63 through 65.
Okay.
South Plains College 61 through 63, okay. The school years.
How aware of you when you were in college of the Vietnam War or... You know, it really wasn't the quote-unquote war at that time, but American policy towards Southeast Asia.
I was a person. I liked history, and I was also in what we call government political science now,
mm-hmm.
Tech. And we were aware of it. It wasn't an overriding element of our thought, but it was in the background, and I knew where it was. I knew where Southeast Asia basically was, mm-hmm. that whole area. I knew where Laos was. Could even pronounce the word Laos. Which President Kennedy couldn't for a while.
That's right. He sure could.
And I was basically because I liked international relations. I was aware of it. I personally was aware of it. And most of my fellow students were too. The ones that I associated with, at least.
Okay. All right.
If that makes sense, what I'm saying.
It does. What did you think about what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia? Do you think it should have been involved at this point or not?
I think so. I thought at the time, though I'm not sure that I was articulated the same way, but I thought at the time that. Yeah, that was part of our policy of containing communism,
okay.
and I still do.
Okay,
and that was a normal progression from one thing to another. That was part of the whole milieu of containing communism.
Okay,
and therefore I think it was a noble cause.
Okay, who's the first president you voted for?
The first president I voted for was Johnson,
Johnson.
Because I couldn't vote until I was 21.
Oh, okay. That's
and
right.
I did vote for Johnson. I suppose.
Okay.
Back in that year, I was relatively liberal. I was a Kennedy Democrat for a long time. And by the way, today, I've gone from being a liberal to a conservative back to a moderate. And I'm a moderate right now. I'm
okay.
a moderate phase of life right now.
Okay.
Moderate to somewhat, maybe left to center.
Okay.
But I would have voted for Kennedy at the time.
Okay. What did you think? I was going to ask you, what do you think of President Kennedy's policies?
President Kennedy's policies, I was one of those people who admired him so much. He was so charismatic.
Uh-huh.
Virtually everything he did I thought was wonderful, frankly.
Okay.
That he couldn't do wrong.
Uh-huh.
I see that he could now, but at the time I didn't.
Right. And what about Lyndon Johnson?
Lyndon Johnson basically the same way, except that he wasn't a charismatic person, but a lot of his, like his civil rights stance, mm-hmm. I believed in, and because at the time, like the Gulf of Tonkin era, that sort of issue.
1964.
President Johnson, whatever he thought, I thought that he was making the right decisions.
Okay.
In fact, I didn't question it because I didn't question that thing the way I probably should have, or the way I would have today.
Okay. Do you think that's because of your youth, or your following Johnson so much? Or
I think all those things, plus the era was an era of trust, which I suspect we probably at least lost some of that trust.
What was the mood on Texas Tech's campus while you were here?
We were basically conservative campus. I was a member of the Young Democrats, and we were a bunch of scraggly people, and the Young Republicans, they were all over the place, and they were a little more well-heeled than we were. They were much more of them than we were, and it's basically conservative. It was a conservative campus at the time.
Okay.
We, trying to describe, it seems sort of superficial right now, but the big issue on the campus was the name change. I was one of those that wanted it to be Texas State.
You favored Texas
State.
I
was one of those crazy social science persons who wanted Texas State. Many people, the more conservative people, wanted to maintain the Tech, name. And many people wanted to maintain the Texas Technological College, or just change the Texas Tech College. I wanted Texas Tech University, and the compromise at Texas Tech University was great. I think it's wonderful now. I'm very proud of it now, but at the time I didn't like it.
Okay.
I was, in fact, the only demonstration that I ever had was when we were demonstrating in a very peaceful, calm, orderly way, demonstrating for Texas State.
Okay,
and
so it's
people over sociology and government and history and like people like us.
Was that the only demonstration you saw?
Yeah, that's the only thing.
It was a name change.
It sounds silly now. But
I remember reading about that in old university dailies.
It was a burning issue in that era, of course.
I can imagine. Now, you graduated in 1965. Did you know you were going to get drafted?
No, the draft was not an important issue then.
Okay.
In fact, I really didn't get a draft deferment a couple of years I was in college, and I became a teacher after I graduated. That's what I wanted to be, and I wasn't one of those people who became a teacher to avoid the draft. The draft wasn't an issue until maybe a year later.
Okay.
And I found out I needed to get a draft deferment because I was called up for a physical, I think, in January of 66.
Okay.
And I was already a teacher. I think that's when it was. I was out of the draft, out of the Brownfield draft board.
Okay.
And that's the first time it became kind of important. And I promised my superintendent, school superintendent, that I would go for a draft deferment.
Okay.
And he supported me in that.
Okay.
In that year, they weren't drafting teachers anyway.
Okay. So when you graduated from Tech in 65, this is spring of 65, you went into teaching. Where did you teach?
I taught at Health Center. Taught at Health Center for 3 years until I went in the Army.
And high school teacher?
Junior high social studies.
Okay.
And I really wanted to teach high school, but I found out later I was one of those weird people that enjoyed junior high students.
Okay.
Very few people do, but I did.
Okay.
And still do, actually.
Yeah. So this is 66, and when you went into the military, when? When did you actually?
I went in 5 August 68.
Okay, so you've got we got some time here. What did you continue teaching there all the way up until?
Yeah, well, in fact, basically the way it happened is I began teaching in August of 65.
Mm-hmm.
In 67, I got married.
Mm-hmm.
I was married to Sharon Cobb.
Uh-huh.
And
did you guys meet at Tech or?
We met on a blind date.
Did you really?
Yeah,
okay.
One of my students' parents asked me at a basketball game if I had a girlfriend, and I'd just broken up with someone who was a Tech student, by the way. And I said, no, ma'am, and the rest is history, actually.
Okay.
And it was married, and I knew Sharon for about a whole six weeks, and we became married.
Okay. So it was 1967?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
67, and I went through the next year, and the last day of school, I stopped by the post office to pick up my mail because I hadn't picked it up the day before. Right before I went to work, I went and picked it up, and I was reclassified 1A.
Oh, wow.
And that was beginning to be the height of the war.
Yes.
And people were getting drafted, pretty frequently.
Yes.
And by the end of the summer, by August, I got my draft notice. I went down and talked to the draft board, and they said, you probably, if you want to go in, the secretary of the draft board told me that I probably should go the Army, the Air Force, someone to talk to a recruiter and try to get, you know, some sort of job that wouldn't require combat arms, which I wasn't that concerned with at the time, though I'm kind of a naive person most of the time about things. So I went to the Army recruiter and said, hey, and I shot straight with him. I said, hey, I'm not going to go in unless I get drafted, but if I get drafted, I'd like to, you know, take a shot at maybe going to the officer program. So I enlisted for infantry OCS. Infantry was all that one could get at that time.
Which you enlisted?
I enlisted, yeah. Okay. I was by the way, let me digress in saying this, that when I went to AIT, Advanced Individual Training in the Army, I decided I really didn't want to be an officer. I didn't have orders for Fort Benning for infantry OCS. I had orders for Fort Leonard Wood for engineer OCS. And so I really didn't want to do that, so I waived it, and I found out I was only had a two-year obligation, so I was a two-year regular Army, two-year RA.
Okay.
And so I was only in the Army 2 years.
Okay, all right. So when you got your draft notice, your Class 5-1A, you decided to take action in your
name? I took action. In fact, when I went to talk to the draft, our superintendent told us, hey, go down and talk to the draft board.
Right.
And I went down and talked to her. And I drove from Brownfield back to Lubbock and went directly to the Army recruiter and talked to him that afternoon.
Okay. And why the Army and not
it's a family tradition.
Really?
Family tradition, yeah.
Okay. Tell me about that. What kind of military influence did you have?
I'm sorry, say again, please.
What kind of military influence did you have?
Oh, my Uncle James T., whom I was named after, was in the Army in World War II. And prior to that, I had a... James C. Bussey was a corporal in the 17th Alabama Infantry in the Civil War, and I just felt like in the Army was my family had always talked about the Army, and that's really what I wanted to do. I never got the Air Force, the Navy, or anybody else in consideration.
Okay.
Briefly, when I was about a freshman in college, I gave the Marine Corps a little bit of consideration for their platoon leaders course, but I didn't do it, and sometimes I wish I had.
Okay. So. What happens after you enlist in the Army? How much time did you have to go before you had to report?
Almost immediately.
Really?
Yeah, a couple of weeks, I guess, or maybe less than 2 weeks, actually. Mm-hmm. I've got my draft notice at home somewhere. I don't remember where it is.
Okay.
Oh, no, I don't remember. I should have brought it over. I don't remember what the date is.
Okay.
But I enlisted and went to Fort Dix on August the 5th.
Okay.
And there were four of us at in Amarillo, what we used to call the AP station.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being sent to Fort Polk, Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
I was sent to Fort Dix because I was an officer candidate.
In
that
New
time.
Jersey?
That's what they did. In New Jersey, yeah.
Right.
Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Had you ever been that far away from home?
Yeah, I really had. I went on the 1957 Boy Scout Jamboree, okay. And we were poor, but my mother and I and my dad scraped enough money together to send me on the Jamboree. We went all the way from here to Ontario.
Wow.
And over to New York. All across New York, Finger Lakes area to New York City, and then back down to Pennsylvania.
Wow, so you
North Carolina.
Had done some travel.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay.
And we had gone through, growing up, I had a great-grandfather who lived in Wyoming, and we had visited him. And my dad used to take us when I was younger, on the wheat harvest. So I'd gone through the central part of the United States on the wheat harvest with my dad.
Okay.
When I was a little guy.
Okay. So, now... From 65 to 68, the tempo of the war in Southeast Asia was really increasing.
Yeah, it was an incremental sort of thing from hardly anything at all to a very hot war, mm-hmm. obviously, at that time.
Mm-hmm. How concerned were you of getting going into something like that?
I was somewhat concerned, especially after I got married.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be an old soldier talking, you know, it never concerned me that much. I didn't worry about it. In fact, when I got orders for Vietnam, it was kind of a relief that I finally found out where I was going to go, and it didn't bother me at all. In fact, I was kind of pleased that I could actually go be part of history, I guess.
Okay.
And you're the only one I've ever said that to, by the way.
Okay. Well, what did you think of U.S. policy? You know, it was slow, like you said, slow incremental, kind of going up and up and up.
Yeah.
How much were you aware of U.S. policy?
I was constantly aware of it. I didn't. Now I believe that we should have. I firmly believe that we should have increased our participation
mm-hmm.
early on, initially. What is it called? Overwhelming force.
Mm-hmm. Like 1965. Yeah.
Exactly.
Go
in with as much as we could.
Okay.
And perhaps have gotten it over with. in a more expeditious sort of way, that we increased it too gradually, and that we were matched tit for tat by the enemy, and I think that was a mistake.
Okay.
At the time, I wasn't aware of it that much.
Okay.
I knew we were there, and I watched the news every evening, and I was, since I was a little kid, I've been a news hound anyway, and I watched it every evening and followed it as much as I could.
Okay.
I was very aware of the Tet Offensive, and I just knew at the time of at the end of Tet that we had lost. Walter Condit told us we had.
Lost the war?
I lost the war, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that Tet showed us that we couldn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was a bad mistake that the media... I'm sorry, I shouldn't...
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Great.
About
super.
The media coverage of the war.
Great. Okay,
absolutely. So... Tell me about Fort Dix. What was that like?
Fort Dix was a very pretty place.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tough post. It was like any army post that provides basic combat training, as they called it at the time.
Mm-hmm. How long was this training?
It was they always said 8 weeks, but it was 9 or 9.5, 10 weeks usually.
Okay.
And I was there from 5 August till. Whenever early October was,
okay.
Whatever day that was, and then, I hate to admit this, let me digress a little bit.
Okay.
When I went in, I couldn't have gotten in the Army normally. I was about 50 pounds overweight, I was a smoker, I was almost 26 years old, and found out later, if you made it to 26, you didn't have to go in. One wouldn't have gotten drafted, but I was a little older. I was one of the oldest in my company, and I was overweight and a smoker, and that was a little tough for a person going in the Army. Physical challenge was immense. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
But I overcame it, and I started after 2 or 3 weeks. I lost enough weight where I started enjoying it, and I didn't smoke quite so much. And I'm one of those crazy people. I really kind of enjoyed basic training.
Did you really?
After a while.
What did you enjoy about it?
The arms training, combat arms, those sorts of things.
Okay. What did you train on? What kind of weapons?
We began with the M14.
Okay.
And in fact, at that time, we were told at Fort Dix and Fort Ory in California that they were training basic trainees with the M14 and then the M16.
Mm-hmm.
So we qualified with the normal qualification procedures that one would go through with the M14.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the M14. And by the way, I'm going to brag, but I was the second highest in my company in rifle marksmanship with the M14 and I scored expert. I really did a good job with that, at least.
Had you done any hunting before?
I was growing up with rifles. It was easy.
Okay.
It wasn't any. That was not a challenge.
Okay.
It was just fun. I even was really good at night firing.
Really?
I could hit targets in the dark really easily.
Okay.
And I'm trying to be humble, but
I
wasn't very good at the other stuff.
Well, what
I
else?
Just barely qualified with my grenade. So
I was going to say, what other weapons?
I was terrible with a grenade. The other was M16.
Okay.
We spent the normal, about a week or a week and a half or whatever with the M14 qualification,
uh-huh.
and that sort of thing. And I don't know, we spent a couple of days all on the M16. I qualified with M16 expert too.
Okay.
And that was fun. At the time, we had heard about these M16s,
mm-hmm.
and when we picked up the M16, it was so much lighter, and we felt it so flimsy that it couldn't be very good until
right.
we fired it and found out it was an excellent weapon.
Mm. Okay. What was so difficult about the grenades?
I'm just a poor athlete, I guess.
So accuracy of throw?
Accuracy of throw was very bad.
Okay.
Unless I'm going to admit to you something I know hardly. I was afraid of those, the live ones. When I threw it, I wanted to get it away, and I didn't get it very far very accurately.
Right. So what kind of small arms did you train on?
Later on, the M1911 45, M79 grenade launcher, mm-hmm. M60 machine gun, and I even cranked off a few M2 machine gun rounds, the 50 caliber rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And... I guess maybe a little bit more than a few. I'm trying to think. Grenades, 70, M79. I guess that's it, maybe.
Okay.
Mines, like Claymore Mine.
Uh-huh.
We were in Vietnam. We, of course, laid Claymore Mines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you say was the most enjoyable aspect of the training? Was it the weapons?
The weapons training, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Besides that, what else did you
enjoy? Silly me, bayonet training. I love bayonet training.
Okay.
I love unarmed combat. I enjoy that sort of thing. The manly arts type things,
uh-huh.
I guess.
Uh-huh.
I enjoyed all that sort of thing.
What was the hardest thing for you?
The hardest thing was running, okay. Frankly, because I was an old fat boy. But I did. I lost 50 pounds of basic training. I lost down from my waist was 40, and I lost down to 34.
Wow.
And my wife saw me, and she really didn't recognize me immediately. I was in uniform and a little guy. Uh-huh. And when I went out, I was a fat boy.
Well, tell me about the training and the people who are giving your training, your instructors. How are they? Were they...
They were the normal drill sergeants. They were tough. The farther one got into the training, the more they relaxed a little bit on the severe discipline. Uh-huh. And I admired them a great deal. My drill sergeant was one of those, you know, that, and you hear veterans say this all the time. I would have gone, you know, fought in hell for him, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. And I would have, you know.
Really?
I liked him a lot.
Really?
I admired him. He was a good guy.
Okay. Were these guys veterans of the
Virtually all of them were. I don't remember anyone, unless they were like E4 below cadre, that weren't veterans. All of them were Vietnam veterans.
Okay.
There was a 11th ACR veteran, a CAV veteran, Big Red One. And, there's one that, what was it, 5th Division up the north with the Diamond, I believe it was.
Okay.
Combat patch. And all of them were veterans. Literally, all of them were veterans.
Did they talk about their Vietnam
experience?
Yeah, they did. Constantly. What did they tell you?
Some of the in quotation cruder ones would tell about killing people. And I'm not sure if it's true what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
My drill sergeant was a little more sensitive than that, and he alluded to that sort of thing, but he didn't. It wasn't as though he was almost bragging about being a combat veteran. His main goal, articulated by himself, was to prepare us for combat to save our lives.
Okay.
And most of us admired him a great deal. He was a Samoan,
really?
By the way. Yeah. And I have a special place in my heart for Samoans now. By the way.
What did he tell you about the combat over there?
He would talk about the jungle being. It was hot, intense combat. He talked about the punchy stakes, booby traps. He had no great animosity against the. I don't think he ever talked about the NVA, but he talked about VC a lot. And I'm not sure when he was there that the NVA were there that much.
Mm-hmm.
But he talked about the VC, and but he did. Some of the other drill sergeants talked as though, you know, they hated the gooks, that sort of thing. But he never did. He was a little more, maybe a little more sensitive than that.
Okay.
And I was in a company of people who were a little bit older. Our average age is 21, and our average education was like 2 years post high school. And so we were kind of an older educated group. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my platoon, we had four guys who had just completed their bar exam.
Really?
Yeah. And one of my real good buddies was a Harvard lawyer.
Mm.
He got his bar exam results when he's in basic training.
Really?
Yeah. His name is Pete Manusak, and he had his undergraduate major, his bachelor's, was in physics at Harvard, and he went to law school.
And then he's in infantry basic training.
That's exactly true, yes, sir.
Wow. So what kind of apprehension did you have, if any, of Vietnam at this point? Here you are in the Army.
I had
infantry.
Some, but not a lot.
Okay.
Well, at the end of basic training, I had a stress fracture. Toward the end.
Okay.
And so I didn't get sent to infantry AIT. I got sent to a signal AIT.
Okay. And just simply because of your injury?
Because of my injury, yeah. What happened is all my friends, most of us were infantry AIT people that were in my company. And most of the guys loaded up on buses the day after basic training and were driven to their AIT companies for infantry basic training. Mm-hmm. And there were several of us who had been injured, including my really good buddy, Robert Krieger, and he had, I don't remember what his injury was, some kind of leg injury or something. He had, such as I did, got it at the end of basic training.
What part did you injure? Was it your ankle?
It was my shin.
Shin?
Okay. My right shin.
Okay.
And so we were sent to a signal AIT at Fort Gordon, Georgia.
Okay. Now, would you have chosen that, or did you want to go infantry?
I hate to admit this. I wanted to go infantry.
Did you really?
You know, yeah, and I hate to admit that sometimes. See, later on, I became infantry qualified in the National Guard. I was an 11 Charlie. I was indirect fire infantry, mortar infantry.
Okay.
And I was about 12-year-old in maturity liberal. You know, I like the soldier stuff, you know, the infantry stuff, and I really enjoyed infantry.
Okay.
We had some light infantry training at the end of my AIT, and a couple of weeks of light infantry training, and I loved every minute I was in it. I hate to admit that to, you know, someone who's an adult, but I did, you know, and okay. I enjoyed it.
What's the most memorable thing about basic thing training that you
about remember? Basic training? Golly, graduation, I guess. Besides getting my the drill sergeant pinning the expert qualification badge on me and calling me Lone Star. I was the only one from Texas. Mm. And he acted like he was really proud of me.
Okay.
Because I think he really thought I was a dud before that. and to some degree, I was a dud.
So your nickname was Lone Star?
Lone Star, yeah, sure was.
Okay. Did that stick with you throughout your...
It stuck with me most of the time through Vietnam because Krieger, my buddy that was in basic training with me, make a long story short, went with me to AIT. I met him at Seattle Tacoma Airport. Mm-hmm. We went out to Fort Lewis, overseas replacement, and from Fort Lewis we went to Cameron Bay. Cameron Bay, we went to Benoit, down to 90th replacement.
Together
at Long Bend Post, and then we got assigned to the same. His bunk was right next to mine in Vietnam.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And so we were together most of our Army, my Army career. Excuse me. And he stayed in Vietnam. He re-upped for Vietnam 3 months so he could have an early out, an educational early out. And I came on home. I was ready to come home by that time.
Right. Okay. What did your wife think about your military training?
She was... The military training, I told her all these stories, and she was always afraid. You know, she was always worried about me, and I reassured her with sometimes lies, and most of the time it's the truth, that my training, you know, about my training. My mother was the same way.
Okay.
I told her all these things, and she was, I don't think she ever really wanted me to go, and she still wouldn't, but she denied reality. She thought there's some way I'd come home, no matter, you know, mm-hmm. right after that, but I never did, of course. My wife didn't like my being in the Army at all anyway.
Okay.
She never did.
Did your family or your wife come out to see your graduation?
No, we were so naive. We didn't realize it, and we couldn't afford it to gone from Hill Center to Fort Dix that way.
Right.
Most of the people who came out to see their sons and brothers and were from that area, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I wish they had. I wish they could have.
Right. So after Fort Dix, you go to Fort Gordon.
Fort Gordon, yes.
In California. Right?
No, sir. Yeah. Fort Gordon is in Georgia. Fort Gordon. It's, come on, brain kick in. I forgot the name of the town now, all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, it
is. Augusta, Georgia. Yeah, Augusta, Georgia.
Okay. What? Tell me about your advanced training. Is Signal Corps?
Signal Corps, uh-huh. Okay. Well, it's basically, we had PT in the morning and PT in the afternoon, like okay. we did, you know, in the other parts of the Army. And we basically learned to operate cryptographic signal equipment,
mm-hmm.
yeah, all the way from the most primitive World War II era equipment, all the way up to, at the time, the most advanced equipment that you could use. We all of us got secret level security clearances.
Mm-hmm. How did you get that? What was entailed?
It was very easy. Later on, I got a top secret. And that was a lot more difficult to get.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they just did a cursory sort of background investigation mm-hmm. on you. And when I applied and got my top secret clearance, they went back and actually talked to people back home, and in both Hill Center and Leveland, and I guess over here at Tech, some of our professors at Tech mm-hmm. Told me later that they had talked to them. They've been interviewed.
Tell me about some of the equipment you trained on.
In signal equipment?
Yes, sir.
We had basically teletype. Mm-hmm. We had, I'm sure you're familiar with the, and I can say this now, I couldn't say this back then, the German equipment during World War II.
Mm-hmm. The Enigma?
The Enigma sort of equipment. Basically that type of equipment, believe okay. it or not. And I didn't realize then that later on I saw, hey, that looks like the equipment we had, you know, when you see the pictures of the Enigma uh-huh. equipment later on. All the way up to equipment that was very primitive, computer equipment. Very primitive computer equipment.
Okay.
But basically, it was teletype sort of equipment. When I got to Vietnam, it was World War II era equipment. It was very primitive field type equipment.
Okay. So you did PT, you did your equipment training. What else did you do?
Later on we'd do some weapons training with the M16. Those who didn't have M16 qualification, which was most of them, qualified with the M16 later on. Mm-hmm. And then right after I graduated, we were sent to a 2 weeks course in what we would call it today. I forgot what they called it then, but it was basically light infantry. Okay. It's patrolling, recon patrols, ambush patrols, mm-hmm. Securing villages.
They taught you how to do all this.
Yes, they did.
Did they teach it in accordance to what was going on the ground in Vietnam?
That's exactly
general?
What it was. No, it was not in general. It was basically related to Vietnam. Attacking and clearing a village, those things of that nature. It was simulated Vietnamese village. Hmm. Is what it was.
Hmm.
With simulated booby traps and the whole thing.
Wow. How was that training? Was it useful for you when you got into the country?
It was basically useful for me, but we really got retrained when I got there, frankly.
Okay.
But it was more. I think it's more valid than what most of the guys got who came in country.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is really pretty good.
Okay.
But we didn't really get retrained.
Where was this 2 week course?
I'm sorry.
Where was this two week course?
It was at Fort Gordon.
Oh, same place.
Yes, sir.
Okay. How would you rate your instruction that you received there at Fort Gordon?
The instruction basically was extremely good.
Okay.
There were a few people who I was a teacher, so I was a little bit critical at least of that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. most of them were really pretty good teachers.
Okay.
And I found out the equipment was as up to date as one could hope for.
A lot of classroom training.
A lot was classroom training, yes, but okay. a lot of it was on hands-on sorts of training also.
Okay. All right. How long did your AIT?
13 weeks, I think.
13?
I think so.
Were you able to go home at all between Fort Dix and Fort Gordon?
No. In fact, they flew me from Philadelphia International to Augusta.
Okay.
Augusta, whatever airport.
Okay.
And about a week after we graduated basic training, a bunch of us were rounded up and flown down to Augusta.
Okay. So when did you finish your advanced training at Fort Gordon?
Let's see. It was right before Christmas.
1968.
1968. It would have been late November, and then I had 2 weeks of that light infantry training, and then we got to go home for Christmas. For 30 to leave right before came to Vietnam.
30 days. Okay.
Yes,
now, did you know you were going to Vietnam before Christmas?
Yeah. The story going around was, if you waved Officer Candidate's Cup,
uh-huh.
This was scuttlebutt. I don't know if it's true or not,
mm-hmm.
That you would get orders for Vietnam if you waved OCS. And waving OCS was an extremely difficult thing to do. One went from a staff sergeant all the way up to a lieutenant colonel being told that I was no good bum for doing that sort of thing.
Oh, wow.
I did go through the process of waiving it, and 2 days later I did get orders for Vietnam. I don't know if there's a correlation there.
Right.
But that's really what happened.
How did you feel when you got your orders for Vietnam?
I was relieved.
Okay.
I was relieved. It was difficult to tell my wife. I felt like I had to tell her as quickly as I could, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I was such a coward, I waited until Christmas to tell my parents.
Did you?
But they kind of suspected it anyway.
Why did you wait?
I wanted to make it the proper way of telling them rather than on telephone. I wanted to see them, you know,
mm-hmm.
to be right there with them.
How'd they feel?
Physically. They were both very worried and very concerned. And my dad was proud. Dad was proud of me whatever I did, you
mm-hmm.
know. But they were both very worried. My wife was frantically worried all the time I was gone, by the way.
Okay. So you had 30 days.
Yeah.
We shipped out.
Yeah.
And anybody in your hometown there in Level Land, did they have draft orders to go to Vietnam? Were you aware of anybody else?
Not really. I'm beginning to find more and more who did now mm-hmm. Since the we have a person who is taken on himself to have a website for the Level Land alumni, mm-hmm. and I asked him one day, please send me names or have those who are veterans to send mm-hmm. me their names and their story, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, and I'm beginning to find out people who did that I actually
okay.
knew.
Okay.
None in my own class. There were a couple of them, I guess, in my class. I graduated with about 150, and we only had a couple that, maybe three of us who went to Vietnam.
Okay. Now, how did the population of Level Land or the civilians that you ran into, mm-hmm. now unless you're in the military and the Army, go into Vietnam? Did you have any kind of adverse reaction? Or what did they say?
Not at that time then. My dad was proud of me and took me downtown and wanted me to wear the uniform,
okay.
in which I was proud to do. Uh-huh. I was proud to be a soldier. And he introduced me around, you know, as people I really already knew, and told them I was going to Vietnam, and they were supportive of that at that time. At least on the surface, they were supportive.
Okay.
Either that, or they were very supportive, and they were dad's friends who would naturally be supportive for that sort of thing.
Okay.
And the same is true about Hill Center, and my home of record was Hill Center.
Okay.
By that time, and the same is true of Hill Center.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you shipped out for Vietnam in January 69?
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. It was 14 January.
Okay. Well, tell me how you got, where you went. How you
okay.
Got
I on plane, I flew to Seattle, Tacoma,
uh-huh.
and I and a couple of other guys who had been in AIT met each other at the airport, accidentally bumped into each other. One was Krieger.
Wow.
The buddy I alluded to before, and we decided we didn't want to go out there right now. It was the night, and we wanted to wait till the next morning to go to do the horrible deed of going out to Fort Lewis back in the Army. So we took a motel room, and the place was full of soldiers doing the same thing we were.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up in the morning, and the bus was there to take us to overseas replacement, and we got to overseas replacement. It was too full. It was filled up. So we were put over on the main post next to a... MP barracks,
mm-hmm.
and they opened up the barracks there for us, and we were housed there, which was fortunate in that anyone who went to main post invariably got put on KP or some other odious fatigue duty.
Mm-hmm.
So if one stayed out on the main post and took his meals at, like Krieger and I did over at the MP barracks,
mm-hmm.
You didn't have to do KP or whatever.
Right. How long did you stay there?
I was there a couple of days.
Okay.
And it was the most beautiful country in the world. It was staggering. It's so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Rainier was in the distance. Mm-hmm. And we had what they told us was a rare snowfall during the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in January. And it was very, very pretty. Yeah, but chilly.
Right. Right.
And basically what I did, I hung around the barracks and read, listened to the radio. Another guy and I went and bowled the night before. I bowled the best game I've ever bowled in my life. And the next night we were loaded on a plane at Air Force Base.
Okay.
And flew to Vietnam. It's TWA airplane,
right.
by the way.
Right.
I even have some stuff from that. I think they have a little chess piece I got there.
Hmm.
And went to Honolulu. From Honolulu, I think it's Guam. Then into to Clark Air Base, which I think is under about 9 meters of ash now, I think. And then mm-hmm. into Cameron Bay.
Okay. What was the mood on the plane when you left the States?
Say again,
what was the mood on the plane when you left the States?
The mood on the plane was we were glad to be on the plane, and most of us were relieved to be going. There were, at that time, we kept hearing stories about people who refused to go, mm-hmm. and I didn't see any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us were pretty relaxed, and I guess there was some element of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were sort of scared, but most everyone was accepting and fatalistic about, you know, going to the war. And it was really pretty good. We wanted to enjoy our last few minutes. We had a Bob Hope movie, and,
mm-hmm.
and the chow on the plane was pretty good, and mm-hmm. it was fun to see Honolulu, the airport there. And
mm-hmm.
it was fun to see Guam, fun to see Clark Air Base. Clark Air Base gave us a little bit of a feeling about what the temperature was going to be like
right.
in Vietnam.
Right.
And but when we left... When we left Fort Lewis, it was cold.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we got on the plane, a bunch of us, including me,
mm-hmm.
Fell asleep. And I remember the captain of the airplane came over the intercom and told the flight attendants, hold the food service right now, let's let them sleep. And that's almost direct quotation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we slept, and for a little while then woke up, and they brought us the food. And they were... TWA did a really good job, by the way. That was the best airplane flight I've ever had in my life, by the way.
Interesting.
You know, I've been to Vietnam twice,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I flew to R&R in Japan, and nothing came close to that flight.
Hmm.
About being people who were very nice to us.
Okay.
They really were.
When you say everybody was fatalistic about going to Vietnam, what do you mean?
I'm not sure how to say it. It's we may as well be accepting. And go ahead and do her job, and that's the people, the mood of the people around me, at least on the plane. And I say fatalistic. That almost has a negative connotation, but it really wasn't that negative. Okay. When we got there, all of a sudden we were all frightened. Mm-hmm. I remember I was scared. I was one of the safest places in Vietnam, Cameron Bay. I didn't know that at the time. But,
Tell me about that when you landed. What were your first impressions of the country?
My first impression was
when you stepped off the plane.
Everyone was came off the plane. Okay, when we came off the plane, the first thing that one always remembered, I think I told you before, was it was very hot. very humid, and it really smelled bad. those were the first reaction that I had. You know, I couldn't believe it was that hot.
Right.
That human beings lived in that kind of environment.
Right.
And then we were loaded on buses, and the buses had the bars and the wire on the windows, mm-hmm. And we already knew what that was for, you know. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize it, but we were on an airbase. And the airbase was very, very well protected. But we didn't know where we were, and I remember being scared, and everyone was scared on the. We didn't talk.
Really.
We sat there in almost stone silent until we got to the overseas replacement station, and then and we were all of a sudden it started hitting some of us. Today we'd call it jet lag, mm-hmm. and we didn't know what jet lag was back then. But I remember getting off the plane and. I think I had a meal, but I'm not sure. I remember that night I slept on a concrete slab.
Did you really?
With my AWOL bag for a pillow.
Where, at the overseas replacement?
Yeah, they assigned us a bed, but about the time we were supposed to go to sleep, mm-hmm. they fell us out to an assembly area. And theoretically, I guess they were going to put us on an airplane over at the back on the airbase or something. I never had figured out why we didn't. We spent hours out there on that assembly area. Eventually, most of us just fell asleep on the concrete slab. We were just tired. And it wasn't until the next day that we were loaded on C-130 and sent south to Benoit Air Base.
Okay. So why did you go to Benoit?
Benoit was close to where my duty assignment was going to be.
Okay.
We were sent from Cameron Bay to Benoit. Benoit, we were taken to the 90th replacement at Long Bend, mm-hmm. Long Bend Post, mm-hmm. Home of the infamous Long Bend Jail, LBJ. And I spent a day and a night, I guess, at 90th replacement, and found out I had orders for 2nd Field Forces, which company clerk came and picked Krieger and me up. Yes. Seemed like there was another guy there too. I don't quite remember.
Did you know your orders exactly what you were going to be doing?
Well, I was too stupid to read them, and I really didn't until the administrative clerk that checked us in. Kind of explained it to us. I was a dumb, naive person. I didn't know. Now I can see those same orders. I know exactly what that stuff meant. Mm-hmm. I didn't then.
Okay. So you were with Krieger.
I was a real rookie.
Well, yeah. You were with Krieger?
Yeah, Krieger. I know.
Okay. So that must have, is that a good comfort for you to have this guy?
Yeah, it really was. Krieger sometimes could be very irritating, but most of the time he was a good guy. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed his friendship, and he and I were good friends. And it was good to have somebody that I knew. Mm-hmm. I'd known him since basic training.
Right. Where was he from?
He was from New York. He's from, Cayuga, New York. Genesee County.
So
it's in the
really,
Finger Lakes area.
Really far away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Loveland,
yeah, he always sort of acted like I was a hick.
Uh-huh.
or he thought, I think he thought most Southerners were hicks anyway.
Okay.
And that was one of the bones of contention I had with Krieger. But and sometimes I talk negatively about Krieger, but Krieger was really a good friend.
Okay.
He's really more like a brother.
Yeah. So what was Benoit like? Very busy airbase.
Yeah, it was a very busy airbase. There were all kinds of flights. I got to see things like F-4s. Seems like there was F-104s there. There were all kinds of helicopters around. There were some civilian aircraft. Of course, you've always heard the term, the Silver Birds, the 707s, DC-9s, I think, commercial aircraft, but mostly military aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And later on, I went down to Tanzania Air Base, mm-hmm. and it was very much the same there.
Okay.
Except it wasn't really quite as busy as Benoit.
Okay.
It didn't have the helicopter traffic, for example,
okay.
or the small plane type of traffic.
What was your impression of the men that you, when you first got there, of the people who were already, the military, U.S. military personnel who were already there in the country? How were they treating you?
They were a little patronizing because we were rookies.
Mm-hmm.
We had the fresh uniforms on, and and we didn't really know how to wear it right, and we didn't have that kind of bleached out look that most veterans would after a while. We hadn't lost Krieger was pretty skinny, but I was not unskinny, but at the time I was a little unskinny at the time, and later on I'd lose some more weight, but we didn't have that real lean look that we were very obvious new in country. And they were a little patronizing at the beginning. When I got to my unit, one of my first impressions was, first of all, we went to a mess hall, and a rat ran across the hall, ran across the mess hall, and I thought, whoa, what kind of place is this? That big old rat.
Where was this?
No, this was actually in my company. It's A Company, the 53rd Signal Battalion. And after we checked in right before noon chow, they sent Krieger and me over to get chow before they finished checking us in, and that was really my first impression of anything in Harley in Vietnam was that rat running across the mess hall floor.
So where were you located? Where was the 53rd Signal Battalion?
53rd Signal Battalion was on a place called Plantation Base Camp. We call it Plantation Base Camp or Hurricane Base Camp sometimes. Mm-hmm. 2nd Field Force Base Camp is 2nd Field Force Headquarters.
Okay. And you arrived, you were there basically within a week after arriving in country?
About maybe 4 days. Maybe 4 days, yeah.
Okay.
It was very quick. I was still jet lagged like crazy. In fact, that night, after we got our bunks and we kind of got settled in, one of the guys was having a farewell party. And I've never been much of a drinker, hardly anything. And they decided that I needed to join the party, so I joined the party. Had a couple of shots of bourbon. It was really good bourbon, by the way. And I got probably as drunk as I ever have been in my life because I jet lagged and had a little bit of alcohol, which I wasn't really used to. And I don't remember much else except about mid morning the next morning. I woke up and it was so hot I couldn't stand it, darling. And I was a little bit hungover. Krieger was very hungover, by the way.
Okay. So what did you guys do when you first arrived?
We were checked in through the company clerk and then sent to supply, and we drew our bedding, drew a weapon. I already had a protective mask because I had to have glasses inserts, spectacle inserts in it. Drew ammunition. We already had most of our field gear. I got most of my field gear in Cameron Bay. And by the way, we were allowed 70 pounds. I didn't realize it, but my personal gear was 70 pounds, not to mention what more, another 60 pounds I drew in Cameron Bay, and I lugged all that back to the company. And then about the only field gear we didn't have by the time I got there was our weapon and ammunition, grenades, things like that.
Okay.
And we drew that, and then we were assigned to a hooch, one of our barracks, and we had our bedding, and basically they left us alone for a while. Told us where the mess hall was, if they needed something, brought to the orderly room, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And we were introduced to our platoon sergeant and welcomed in. And I can say that most of the guys were a little bit patronizing, but they were glad to see us. And we were welcomed into kind of a brotherhood or a fraternity of people who were there. Which made you feel good.
I'm sure. How many people were you living with there in that area?
Let's see, there would have been probably, I think our hooches usually had about maybe 15, maybe less, maybe 12 to 15 people perhaps.
Okay.
Maybe no more than 12.
Okay.
Not to include some of the NCO rooms. We had a couple of NCO rooms at one end of the hooch that were built in.
Okay. So what were your duties when you first
I first got there, we theoretically were supposed to have 2 weeks where we would become acclimated to the country, and where we did traditional things like fill sandbags and say things of that nature, which we did for about 2 days. Krieger and I did for about 2 days. They needed people so badly because they were short of personnel that we were almost immediately put to work. We had two communication centers. We had what we call the main communication center, which was high volume, low priority type messages. And we had the Tactical Operations Command for 2nd Field Force Comm Center, which was the high priority, highly classified material that went out to divisions and commanders of 2nd Field Force and things of that, and actually into Benoit Air Base and over to Long Bend Post.
Okay.
But and we were both assigned to the Tactical Operations Command.
Okay. Just to fill a seat, or
I don't
were
know.
You chosen?
I was chosen. I don't know. He and I had both done well in AIT and our school, you know, and maybe that was it. I'm really not sure.
Okay.
I never really did know why we were two of the chosen to go over to Top. Top was theoretically a really good assignment.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do there?
We handled messages between. Things like from the different divisions in 3 Corps,
mm-hmm.
That came into to the commander of 2nd Field Forces.
Mm-hmm.
We also handled messages are coming in from places like Washington D.C. for example,
mm-hmm.
Different kinds of field commands,
mm-hmm.
From Pentagon, from. It's classified time. We even got a message in from President Nixon which was a particular kind of message that I'll tell you about in a minute, which mm-hmm. was highly classified back then.
Mm-hmm.
But we even handled one from him to different division commanders.
Hmm. When you say handle messages, can you describe it?
We would get a message in. It was teletype and it was paper tape.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of primitive teletype equipment,
mm-hmm.
and we transferred those electronically.
Mm-hmm.
From the sources that came in the comm center out to the different destinations, plus we maintained messages for the tactical operations commander for 2nd Field Forces, which was the commander.
Okay.
2nd Field Forces.
So you could read all this stuff.
Yeah. In fact, for a while we would get ArcLight messages in,
mm-hmm.
and we'd read about them in something like the Stars and Stripes or something,
mm-hmm.
a day or two
mm-hmm.
later, and they would tell about. Where some place was bombed, and we knew that wasn't the real place they were bombed. It was Cambodia or someplace, you know.
Really?
Yeah, we'd get those kind of things in.
Now, were you still secret clearance, or did you?
It was still secret. Later on, I became I got a top secret clearance, and I was one of the two or three at the top comm center who handled top secret messages coming in.
How many people were there under that roof?
Under that roof, there were probably 8 or 10, depending on. It was a small comm center,
okay.
8 or 10.
Okay.
Plus, once in a while, you'd have a NCOIC who was E6 or above,
mm-hmm.
but hardly ever. Most of the time, E5s were the main, what we call trip chiefs. They were in charge of that particular shift in that comm
mm-hmm.
center.
Okay.
And once in a while, you'd have an OIC who was usually a warrant officer.
Mm-hmm. Was it air conditioned?
It had to be because, thank God, it had to be because it was the equipment was very, very sensitive equipment.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it had to be air conditioned.
Okay.
Some of the old tubes that we had right there were very, very delicate,
mm-hmm.
and they had to be air conditioned. I don't know what they did out in the field sometimes. So we had a place that we called Hill 837.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of our battalion. An element from our battalion mm-hmm. Maintained it, and they had a little comm center out there. And I don't know what they did. It was the most primitive conditions you can imagine. Short of being in a Vietnamese controlled village of some
mm-hmm.
kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't because I didn't have any air conditioning out there.
Okay.
So
what was your daily routine like?
Daily routine would we had 2 weeks 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night
mm-hmm.
on shift.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get up somewhere in the neighborhood of 4:30 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
Have morning formation, breakfast, and then and go to work at the
mm-hmm.
comm centers, sometimes fatigue duty, and work till lunchtime, come back to the company area for lunch, go back till 1800,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd be relieved, and then go down and have chow at 1800. Sometimes we'd have chow at 1700 if something different was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And just the reverse was true at night, though. We had a night shift from 1800 to 0600 in the morning. And we had the only time we left there was go to the latrine or to go to what we call midnight chow.
You didn't work both shifts, did you?
Off and on, yeah. We sometimes did, yeah. And then once or twice a week we'd have guard duty or a recon patrol or something like that.
Okay. So you actually went out in the field a few times?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
The guard duty was relief. That was kind of... You got away from the believe it or not, the high stress of communications here. Guard duty is really pretty good. You know, you got to Sit in a bunker and watch tracer rounds go over your head. Things like that nature.
Would you say stressful in the center?
Let me give you an example. We would get flash messages through. Flash messages had to be perfect, and they had to be transmitted with the greatest of alacrity. There was one kind of flash message that called a red rocket, which that term used to be classified, by the way. Red rockets originated from the Pentagon and from the White House, and they had to reach their ultimate destination, wherever it was in the world, in 20 minutes. And we practiced expediting red rockets.
20 minutes from the time you received it, or 20 minutes from the time they sent it?
From the time it's sent.
Wow.
It had to reach its destination in 20 minutes.
Okay.
And we practiced that constantly. I mean, that was the priority message worldwide.
Right.
We actually had a red rocket come through one night, but we had to get things right because people's lives were at stake.
Right.
And it was constantly working. You never stopped working, and you could hear when I first started doing it, when I went back to the house to try to go to sleep, I could hear that equipment. And it nearly drove me crazy for a while until I really got used to it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And that was stressful.
How many of these red rocket messages would you have?
We only had one when I was there.
Oh, really?
And that's a little bit of a story, too.
Okay.
I was the trick chief that night. It was later on after I became a buck sergeant.
What do you mean, trick chief?
That was he, the leader of that ship about four or five guys.
Okay.
And that night, it was Saturday night, mm-hmm. and there were only three of us available. The other guys were... I don't remember. I guess they were on guard duty or something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe CQ. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there were only three of us, and I had to go do some work on a secure telephone system, which I really don't know how to do much. But I
mean, repair it or?
Well, it was to change it over to where it could be secure.
Okay.
A secure card was placed in the apparatus.
Okay.
And I was the only one on the trick that could do that. The other guy went to Chow, and we left a guy there back in the comms. We only had one guy in the comms there when that red rocket came through. He was the worst dud in the whole company, literally. And he handled it perfectly. He saved all of our lives. He really did. You know.
Do you remember what it said, the red rocket message?
I really don't remember.
Okay.
I wish I did.
Uh-huh.
I really don't. And I do know that it originated with the White House, and it went to all of our divisions. And this guy was able to...
He got it dispersed.
He got dispersed beautifully. I mean, it could have been better.
Great.
He rose to the occasion. And I almost passed out when I had a red rocket with that guy coming through.
that's
he really did a good job.
That's cool. Okay, sir, could you tell me about... We discussed a little bit about A Company and kind of what you guys did. How did you see yourself in relation to the other companies?
Well, we were a little bit elitist in that we thought that 72 Bravo MOS was communication center specialist, and we felt as though we were a little better than the other people in the Signal Corps, particularly like our company was A Company, which was a comm center company, mostly with a few radio people, but B Company were linemen and those sorts of people who we thought we were perhaps a little smarter than the others, which is not a really a good thing to feel feel like. I have a good friend who was a lineman in B Company who came home right before 10 of 68, which was a little over a year before I got in country.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that, too.
Okay.
He thought comm center people were snobs, I guess. Yeah, he really
now, was
did.
This justified?
Probably not. Okay. Probably I'm kind of an egalitarian person. And I don't think in those terms, but most of the guys did. They really did. And then later on, I was a member of Strategic Communication Command when I was at Fort Detrick, Maryland, after I got back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And those people really do feel like they're the elite of the Army.
Really?
You know, they really do. At least they did then. They don't even have that anymore.
Okay.
But they sure did back then. And they were very snobby people. They really were, as far as soldiers go.
Tell me about some of the other activities. You said you did guard duty.
Yeah.
And was this during the day or night?
It was at nighttime. It was usually we had a kind of an informal guard mount somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 1,800 or so, and then we'd be inspected by the officer of the day, initially we'd be inspected by the sergeant of the guard. And then he would march us over the officer of the day to inspect us, and it was not a very elaborate inspection, as you can imagine, in a combat zone. They wanted to make sure we had all of our equipment there and had plenty of ammunition and that sort of thing.
You carried an M16?
We carried M14s. Most of the time. There's a story about that too.
Why weren't you carrying M16s?
Okay, before we came in. Now this is a story that we were given. We were told by the old guys, the older person, the personnel who'd been there before us, that about the time we were to be issued M16s, they decided to issue them to the ARVNs, Army Republic of Vietnam soldiers. So we never got issued M16s. It was always M14s.
Okay.
We had some M16s. We had some AK-47s. We had some M2 carbines. We had an M3 machine gun. M1 carbine? M1 carbine. And some of the officers decided when they would be part of the guard mount or go out on patrol or something, would carry something like an M1 carbine or an AK-47 or something, or M16.
You actually carried AKs?
They did. The officers did.
Okay.
The officers actually carried. Several of the officers carried AK-47s.
Interesting. Any memorable activities when you were pulling guard duty?
Well, there were all kinds of things.
Like what?
The second time I was on guard duty, what we would have a... one was supposed to have 2 hours sleep, 2 hours awake in a bunker.
Okay. How many people? You're obviously there with another person.
Usually two. Sometimes if you were on personnel, just one person. A lot of times I was just by myself in a bunker. Sometimes as many as three. Three was ideal.
Okay.
And you could sleep in a bunker. At one time I was in a bunker which was covered by two other bunkers on each side of it, and so you could sleep, and the sergeant of the guard would wake you up after a couple. Waking up after a couple of hours. Well, the battalion XO, who had gotten drunk he would get drunk every Saturday night and go out and inspect the perimeter guard
while he was drunk.
Yeah,
okay.
And he decided that I was sleeping on duty. And he kept yelling at me and throwing rocks down into the bunker from outside.
Okay.
And I came out and got chewed out, and I'm sure he forgot about it later on. But I liked him. He was a good soldier. He was ex-British Army, by the way.
Oh yeah.
And I got chewed out for sleeping on guard duty when I was supposed to. We had, all kinds of things happen. We would right after I became a sergeant. First time I was sergeant of the guard. Guard duty was like from 1900 to 0700. And about 1900, it started getting dark. Between our perimeter, which was concertina wire and claymore mines and those sorts of things, to protect your perimeter, there was a road, and then there was another series of part of the fortification for the perimeter, which was more concertina wire and those sorts of things. Well, there was a captain walking without any kind of weapon, without a flak vest, without a helmet, without anything, walking down the after hours when he shouldn't have been there, walking between on the road between the concertina wire. And when he came close to our, we had a little road that was access to that road where he was walking, right next to the company command bunker where I was sergeant of the guard. The officer of the day came up and was talking to me, and I glanced over his shoulder and saw the captain coming down, and I yelled for him to halt, who was there, advance and be recognized. We went through the whole thing, and he started giving me a lot of trouble, and he kept trying to see what my rank was, and my load bearing equipment and my flak vest was over my collar rank. Mm-hmm. And I could tell he was a captain, and I was very respectful, called him sir, but was very adamant about his not walking out there. I told him you could get killed. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had uncapped my my holster on my 45 when he started walking up to emphasize that I really meant business, mm-hmm. you know, that he couldn't do that. So I got one of my troops to escort him around the back of our perimeter to the next company down. The next morning on our bulletin board, congratulations, Sergeant Bussey, on the way you conducted yourself on guard and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I never did know if he was a plant and trying to check us out. I don't think he was. Mm-hmm. I think it was the doofus that was just walking through there. We one night on guard duty, one morning on guard duty, mm-hmm. at about 0600, we went to morning chow. Mm-hmm. The guard, half the guard would go in for chow, then they'd go out, and then the other half would go until 0700. I was sitting with the first group in the mess hall, mm-hmm. And we could hear rockets, 122 millimeter rockets. And they were impacting on Benoit Air Base. So we could hear boom, boom in the distance, explosions. We went out and we could see, we couldn't see Benoit Air Base. We could see about where Benoit Air Base was. Mm-hmm. And there were columns of smoke, which eventually, from Benoit Air Base, covered the entire, from horizon to horizon, kind of magnesium sort of smoke, whatever this material was, mm-hmm. when it would kind of percolate down, it would sting the eyes. It was unpleasant on the eyes. But apparently it had hit aircraft in revetments. And that was one of my experiences on guard duty. Also, one night from a distance, this was the summer of 69, I was in a bunker, and I was the awake type guy. I never did go to sleep on guard duty much. Once in a while I would. I'm a night person. I like the night. Okay. I love the night. And believe it or not, I like to stay up. And okay. So I stayed up. I'd sometimes take the other guy's guard, you know. Now, if we were on red alert, everybody was going.
You're the perfect person to have on
guard. I'm a perfect person to have on guard duty. I didn't want to sleep, and I liked that stuff. Uh-huh. But in the distance, and I hate to admit this, it's beautiful. There was a Arvin POW camp. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, maybe 7, 8, 10 clicks away from us, from our base camp. But it was hit by ground assault, and you could see the flares, and you could see explosions, and hear explosions, and and I hate to admit this, and I've never told this to anyone. It was fascinating to see when it wasn't directed at you, mm-hmm. when one didn't have to experience it himself. It was fascinating to see, mm-hmm. and you can see it very vividly. That's one of my most vivid memories of Vietnam, is seeing that ground assault, and it didn't last very long. It didn't last 20 minutes. Hmm. And they had attack helicopters back over there. That was about the time that the Cobras were deployed to Vietnam, and they were obviously, in fact, one of the Cobras went from our base camp, took off from our base camp about that time and went over that direction.
Hmm. You see the actual helicopters?
You could actually see the helicopters. You could actually see a Puff the Magic Dragon attack one night, where you could see the tracer rounds, you know, the solid line of tracer rounds, and, mm-hmm. and that was frightening, even though it was directed against someone else. Mm-hmm. It's frightening to see. I'm just glad it wasn't us, you know, mm-hmm. being attacked that way. Mm-hmm. But that I hate to admit, but that was interesting too.
Okay.
I hate to admit, but it's fascinating, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I understand that.
We had an officer one night who was who was from A Company, my company, who was a West Point graduate and a really good officer. He was an officer who was respected and liked by the troops, that sort of thing. Well, he got drunk.
Okay.
He went to B Company's part of the perimeter, mm-hmm. and started setting off claymore mines at monkeys.
Oh, gosh.
He got through doing that, and he went over to what we call the battalion theater. It was some logs in front of some boards painted white for a 16 millimeter, you know, mm-hmm. movie screen, and he started shooting I forgot what he was saying. He started shooting his 45 at the in quotations movie screen, at the people on the screen.
Uh-huh.
He disappeared. He went to Hill 837, and he got reassigned there. That was not supposed to be a good assignment, and I hate to see him go, but they reassigned him. That next day he was gone.
Okay. So what other activities besides guard duty? You said you went on some patrols.
We went on some recon patrols, okay. And basically it was just back through the jungle. Everybody had to do recon patrols periodically. Mm-hmm. It was our duty. We were a tactical signal unit, and we were taught to do patrolling, mm-hmm. We were expected to defend our own facility, and that was part of doing that.
How often would you go on this?
You know, I'm really not sure. I think it's about once every 3 or 4 weeks that we did that. Mm-hmm. The guard duty was much more often than that, but patrols like that, that's about right.
It was like platoon size or company size?
It was a lot smaller. It was like maybe a reinforced squad size.
Really?
Yeah. That's basically what it was.
And would you go out for just a day?
We'd go out for just, and I think like it was like 0700 to 0700. I remember I had to have a picture made for a security badge, mm-hmm. and I'd just come back off a recon patrol, and I looked like hell, mm-hmm. and I went over and had that picture made. And the extra pictures I sent to my wife, and she couldn't believe that I looked so bad. But you know, I was dirty and scroungy looking. And, mm-hmm. But
did you ever have any contact with the enemy?
Yeah, once or twice we did.
Can you describe that?
We weren't ambushed by maybe a unit type ambush. We would be ambushed, believe it or not, by individuals or two or three. And one time. There were several of us who were shot at by a guy that just popped up out of the bush and started firing his AK-47, and bless his heart, he fired over our heads, he was killed, by the way, mm-hmm. but it was that sort of thing. It wasn't there was no big deal, as I say, this elaborate, mm-hmm. L-shaped. Ambush or anything like mm-hmm. that where mm-hmm. I was.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel out there in the bush?
It was scary. It was always scary. It was very scary, at nighttime especially. In fact, when I got back, it was kind of tough for me to even go out and into the garbage or something like that sometimes at night. You know, sometimes I'd get that crawly feeling, you know, that you get when you did that. That was just me. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm a night person, that wasn't fun at night.
What did they tell you to look out for the most?
At the time that I was there, for example, we didn't go in the trails. We went up in the jungle beside the trails because mm-hmm. the trails were booby-trapped, and mm-hmm. theoretically the jungle wasn't. Mm-hmm. Well, that changed when I was there, and we had to go back on the trails because then you started booby-trapping mm-hmm. the sides of the trails. And the main thing we had to look out for us was the booby traps with grenades. Mm-hmm. With tripwires, mm-hmm. and basically what they did, they would take a cylinder that the grenade had been stored in, mm-hmm. Put the grenade in there, remove the handle of the grenade, the pin was still in it, though loosened, and attach that to a tripwire, and then when one came through the jungle, it'd trip on the tripwire, pull the grenade out of the cylinder, and it would explode. And that was what we had to look out for. Plus, we had to watch out on guard duty that we actually had claymore mines that were turned facing us instead of out towards the enemy. That we had to watch out for that, too. Hmm.
Did anybody ever hit a tripwire when you were
out on the patrol? Yeah, we had a couple people. One guy flat out would not have lived if it hadn't been for a lieutenant that we had right there that was the best person I ever saw with first aid. He took over, and he was the medic, and he did a super job. He had the guy had his foot blown off, and some other wounds. But basically, it was what they call it, traumatic amputation, you know, sort of thing. We didn't have many punchy stakes. That was kind of passe in my area by the time I was there in '69. Okay. But in most of the time, it was those grenades like that.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of the enemy?
Basically, I respected the enemy. Mm-hmm. I thought the NVA were good soldiers. They had a really good reputation in our area. The 10th Division, the 10th Armored Division, didn't have as good a reputation. It was one of the terms we used in Vietnam was something bad was number 10, and the 10th right. Division had that epithet mm-hmm. of being number 10. Mm-hmm. But the enemy, particularly the Armored enemy, were very highly respected. Or rather, the NVA.
Right.
Yeah, NVA. Uh-huh. The VC weren't very much. We didn't respect them at that time in my area. Mm-hmm. Okay. There weren't that many at that time in my area. It was mostly NVA.
Okay. What did you think of the Arvin?
Most of the Arvins I thought were probably fairly good. The only thing is I'm tempering that because most of the guys we bumped into were 10th Division, and they were obviously not very good.
They had poorly led or poorly trained or poorly motivated?
Both poorly motivated primarily. That was the impression we got.
Okay.
Whether it was valid or not, I'm not sure, but that's what we thought at the time. Okay. And I think there is some much validity to it.
You think there is or is not?
There was. I think there was some validity to that for the 10th Arvin Division. Mm-hmm. Some of the others were pretty good at that time, in our area at least. I had a friend down in the 9th Division down at Dongtown, you know, in the Delta, and he despised and hated the NVA and VC and didn't think they were any of the very good soldiers. But I think that was his. He was prejudging them in a way which was probably not, like I say, not very valid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I had a good impression that they were good professional soldiers.
Okay.
And most of us did in my unit.
How would you rate your leadership, your immediate supervisors, and then the upper echelon?
My first platoon sergeant was one of the best soldiers I've ever known. The next one I got was the only other Texan I ever served with in the Army, and even had an aunt who lived in Levelland. He was
really?
A Texan, actually. I didn't like him very much. My platoon leader and the other officers I respected and liked a great deal. My battalion commander was one of the finest human beings I've ever known. For example, mm-hmm. he would know one's name, no matter whether they were PSCs or whether they were whatever rank. He would say, for example, Specialist Bussy, how are you today? Fine, sir. How are you? Fine. How's your wife, Sharon? Is Sharon still feeling bad about, you know, the loss of your baby? And no, sir, she's feeling better now. And he would know those details like that.
Wow.
And he knew that on all the men. He had a marvelous memory. He was a helicopter pilot and reputedly a good helicopter pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He knew everyone's MOSs in the battalion fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
He could talk to the troops without being patronizing. And that used to gripe me a great deal because some of the other officers would say the lower enlisted man say such and such, and I had to be patronized. Down, and he'd never do that sort of thing.
Do you remember his name?
I had it for a minute and I've forgotten it.
Okay.
I've got it at home.
Okay.
I've got it at home,
okay.
And I can find it. I'd love to know what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
I really would.
Okay.
I remember my my company commander that I liked a lot, and most of the guys didn't like him too much because he's so strict.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked him a lot. He's Captain Thompson.
Okay.
He was a very good company commander.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked me, and that helped too.
Right. Sure. What about the upper echelon leadership in the United States?
I always had confidence in them. We had General Ewell was our second field force
mm-hmm.
commander.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of confidence and respected him a lot. And I actually saw him a couple of times. I actually
really?
Failed to salute him, and he ignored me. He ignored it. He had a big entourage, and he was busy with them. And I remember he glanced at me, and I looked up, and it was too late to salute. He has already turned. Why did I not do? I didn't, but he ignored it, and we had heard that he did not ignore that sort of thing. He would go seek one out,
really?
if you didn't use you know, proper military courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked him a lot. I liked I respected General Abrams a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That was his era, mm-hmm. and I liked him a lot.
Did you ever get to see him?
I never did.
Okay.
I wish I had. And he did visit Second Field Forces once in a while, he was there several times that I was there, but I never did get to see him.
Okay.
I didn't get to see Bob Hope either. But
asking, yeah, what kind of USO shows did you get to see?
Well, we had some things from some people from, mostly from places like the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of those people there, and they were all, most of that stuff was really pretty good. Bob Hope came in and had his Christmas show when I was there in December '69, and we drew lots.
Mm-hmm.
from the battalion to see who could go over, and I don't remember how many did, not too many people got to go over, but it was broadcast on Armed Forces Radio, and we got to hear it from Long Bend. When I got back home, a little over a month later, they showed it on television. He had the Bob Hope Show, and I got to see the part, his whole tour of Vietnam, and part of it was the Long Bend tour. And got to see that, and that was fun. That was one of the better things that I saw. Better things that happened, actually.
You actually went to the show. You saw
that. I didn't get to. I just heard it. So some of the other guys in the company did, and the battalion did, but I didn't get to see it.
Okay. Describe life on the base for me. What was it like?
Well, it was dirty and hot all the time, and we were always thirsty. It was a lot of work. We were working all the time. I remember the first day I got off was where I had a day off was in May. It was right after Ho Chi Minh died, by the way.
Really?
And I remember that. I've got a story about that in a minute, if you like.
Okay.
The first day I got any time off was in May. I'd been there since February. Of course, I'd gone home on emergency leave in February.
Okay.
And I got there in January, rather, and May was the first time I got a day off. And some of those guys had been there for a full tour without ever having a day off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, therefore, guard duty was really a relief.
Right.
And sometimes some of the guys wanted to go on the recon because just to get away from base camp sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But we would get up in the morning and go to work. Go to chow, come back. Most of the time it was pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
In the evening, if you didn't have to work at nights, there was always a movie, except I think either Sunday or Monday nights. We had a battalion movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, our company clerk, I think from what I remember, I was thinking about that the other day, I think he saw every movie they ever showed there.
Really?
He was a real movie buff. He was he had been a reporter for one of the St. Louis newspapers. He just got a job when he got drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a graduate of University of Nebraska, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he went to every movie that was there, but that was part of the routine, to go to the movie. I bought a TV after I got back off emergency leave. There were only two of us that had TVs in the hooch.
Mm-hmm.
I had one which was big enough for one to see. I bought the TV, and we'd watch TV in the evening sometimes. I loved Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Combat was still on when I first got the TV, and that was by far the most popular show in Vietnam for on Armed Forces Television.
Combat.
I don't know if you're familiar. There was a show back in the late 50s, early 60s about World War II squad, infantry squad in France in World War II. And that was basically what it was about. And I cannot think of the actors now. Anyway, that was very popular in Vietnam.
So you were able to watch TV?
Yeah, we were able to watch. Just one, Armed Forces out of Saigon.
Okay.
And what happened is I bought the TV and I was trying to figure out how to get some kind of antenna. We had a scrounger in our platoon.
Mm-hmm.
This guy rigged up an antenna and has got some coaxial cable and wired me up. and I put it, we put it in a place in the hooch where everybody can kind of get their lawn chairs and kind of sit around
mm-hmm.
and watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
Saw the moon landing there, for example. I'm still a TV addict. I read a lot,
mm-hmm.
but always had the TV or something going on,
mm-hmm.
and so I had that TV. I was the only one in there that had the TV set up, and it was kind of the community television.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd watch TV. I read a lot. I read history and science fiction and a lot of things, actually. Biographies.
Did they provide you books? Or?
Yeah, we had a lot of books. Our first sergeant really believed in soldiers being able to enjoy reading because he liked it. He was a Korean World War II veteran, and I don't remember how many stars he had on his CIB badge. But anyway, he was a combat veteran for all three wars. But he believed in people being able to read and having that access. Also, we had a pretty good, comparatively pretty good library,
okay.
and I got a lot of my history from there. Also bought some books there at some of the PXs around the area. I always, when I got a chance, I went to the PXs and sought out places where I could buy books, mm-hmm. and I bought a lot of books on Asian history, Vietnamese history.
Mm-hmm.
and I like biographies that, and I learned some sociology when I was there too, but basically that was it. And most of the time it's boring. I try to write my wife every day, and try to write my parents most every day, but it's usually every 2 or 3 days I wrote my parents and my sisters. Mm-hmm. My dad didn't like to write, and you couldn't tell what he wrote anyway, so he sent me tape recordings. Hmm. And he sent those fairly frequently to me, and I was able to listen to them about once a week. Mm-hmm. I had a little tape recorder. He bought me a tape recorder before I left for that very reason.
Did you ever do any Mars calls back?
Not too long before I came home, I don't know, several weeks before, I said, hey, I want to make a call. And they set me up to do it. They got the call. I just had come in. I don't know where I'd been, but it was a day off, mm-hmm. and I'd been doing something somewhere. And I came into the hooch, and they said, "Hey, hurry! You got your Mars call through." And I was able to talk to Sharon, my wife, for a few minutes. It was very disconcerting for her to have to say "over."
Right.
How are you, hun? Over. I love you, hun. Over. That sort of thing.
Right.
It's hard for me to maintain composure thinking about it. That was a very important thing that happened to me, that Mars call.
Really?
It boosted my morale immeasurably.
Really?
Yeah, I still even get teary-eyed just thinking about it.
And that was 2 weeks before you left?
2 or 3 weeks, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why did it have such a profound effect upon you?
I love Sharon, and I missed her, and Sharon was always constantly worried about me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to her very badly, mm-hmm. And it really had a profound effect on me. It was bittersweet, but it was kind of a precursor to my going home. That was a little bit of sweetening before the dessert of going home. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe if I can use that kind of metaphor.
Sure.
But that Mars, that was a good thing. That was very important for the troops to have that.
Could you do this whenever you wanted to?
It was very, very difficult. Sometimes the guys never could get it done. What happened is we had a radio that was a Mars radio there on the base camp. In fact, one of the guys in our platoon was the main radio operator for it.
Mm-hmm.
And his nickname was Watusi because he was a black guy and he was extremely tall. Mm-hmm. He probably was the upper limit of being able to be in the Army, actually. Mm-hmm. And he was a really good radio operator. But what would happen is that he would make the call and he would find ham operators. The ham operator I had was in Hawaii, maybe Guam, Hawaii, mm-hmm. and then I think somewhere in California. And it seems like it was another place. And they would call one ham operator after another till they got down to the telephone wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
They called Sharon. This is something like 2 o'clock in the morning for her, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, it was a very pleasing experience for her because she just got out of bed, and she couldn't really talk to me through it the way she wanted to, and she had to say that over stuff, and and she still gripes about it actually.
What did you guys do for entertainment besides? You had TV.
There wasn't much. television, movie. I saw a lot of movies there.
Mm-hmm.
I loved movies anyway. I saw a lot of movies when I was there. I read. We listened. We had Armed Forces Radio, which mm-hmm. was really important.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in the hooch always had Armed Forces Radio on. Heard a lot of music and news and things of that nature. We heard the Good Morning Vietnam thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was after Carnell left. I guess they kept that tradition alive because mm-hmm. Because it seems like it's 06:30 in the morning. Somebody would come on and say Good Morning Vietnam, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. he did.
Were you able to keep up with news back in the United States?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, we had Stars and Stripes
mm-hmm.
newspaper. I got Newsweek magazine.
Oh, really?
Then we had Armed Forces Radio and Television. Both had pretty good news desks.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be, for example, it would be like, they would call themselves, this is Air Force Sergeant Smith with the 6 o'clock news or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they would give a basic news broadcast as though it was back home.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Except the guy would be in jungle fatigues.
Right, right.
And that's basically, we kept it very much so that way. For example, Chappaquiddick. Jeff Quiddick. Mm-hmm. That incident happened when I was there. The Sharon Tate murder was there. The we heard about Woodstock. Mm-hmm. Gosh, there's so much. The moon landing. Gosh, 69 was a significant year. Mm-hmm. Nixon sent troops home. We all knew we were going to go home, too.
Yeah, tell me about that. What did you think of U.S. policy at this point? The starting of the Vietnamization policy, turning the war into
exactly.
Vietnamese.
Yeah, exactly. Which we in the unit thought that was a very good idea because we thought we'd get to go home primarily for that reason. I thought that was a good idea personally at the time because I thought that was the type of policy that we should have been maybe practicing all along. Mm-hmm. More of the Vietnamization, mm-hmm. Rather than having us carry so much of the burden anyway. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a smart move at the time, actually, mm-hmm. personally. But
did you feel like Arvin could, or the Vietnamese forces could actually do the job?
Frankly, I and the other people in the unit knew that within 10 years, that would be it would be a communist country, a lot less than that. That's what we thought at the time.
Really?
Yeah. I personally, and most of us, didn't think anything would really work at that time, at that point.
Really?
I thought the Nixon's attempt at what he was trying to do, mm-hmm. Starting late summer, early fall of 69, was the appropriate thing to do at the time. But I really wasn't very optimistic, mm-hmm. frankly.
What did you think of Richard Nixon?
At the time, I thought he was a good president. I wasn't a very strong Republican, mm-hmm. Minded terrorist war. I was still fairly liberal. Mm-hmm. I was giving him the benefit of the doubt mm-hmm. and hoping that he'd do a good job. Mm-hmm. And I really thought at the time he might be doing a good job.
Okay.
Does that make sense the way I'm saying it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what my feelings were at that time. Later on, I deplored some of the things he did. But at the time, I really thought he was doing a good job. Later on, I thought Kissinger was doing a good job, too. When he came on board.
You were aware that the Paris peace talks had
yes,
started.
Yes, sir. Exactly. Yes, okay. sir. I was such a pessimist at that time, I didn't think that they would go anywhere. That would be advantageous to us. At least that was my opinion.
Okay.
That makes sense. But we were very aware. At least we were in my unit at mm-hmm. the time that I was there, mm-hmm. Of things that were going on around us.
Okay.
At least my friends and I were.
What would you say the morale was of your fellow troopers?
We were always in pretty good morale. We always wanted to go home. We perhaps didn't like what we were doing so much, but we didn't mind doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Within the context of being in a combat zone, we were basically a happy people, happy group.
Okay.
We really were.
Okay.
I constantly wanted to come home, but I was basically just, things were okay.
Okay. Were there any racial tensions within your platoon?
Not in my platoon. Between B Company and A Company, there was some.
Really?
In my platoon, in my section, my squad, my section, mm-hmm. there were four guys who were African Americans, mm-hmm. and those four guys were. Among the top 10 friends that I had, and all of us liked each other in a company. Mm-hmm. The races did. There was not that. You always hear about the racial tensions in the Vietnam War. I didn't see that, except there was some problems between some of our guys and some of the African Americans in B Company.
What did you see? What happened?
Let me give you an example. One of my really good friends was a guy named Mattson. Mattson was a...
M-A-T-S-O-N,
Mattson.
Okay.
That's hard for me to say.
No, okay.
Mattson was a guy from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And he was a tall, very amiable, good-natured sort of human being until he got drunk.
Okay.
He was extremely obnoxious drunk.
White guy or black guy?
White guy.
White guy, okay.
And he went in. He would go over to B Company and fraternize with those people or B Company, whatever those people were.
Uh-huh.
It didn't matter the race.
Uh-huh.
And he'd antagonize them. And some of the black guys really took offense
uh-huh.
at some of the things he did. And sometimes would go out looking for him. That sort of thing would happen every once in a while. One of my really good friends was a guy who had graduated from Syracuse University.
Mm-hmm.
He was later on a principal, by the way, back in Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
Got his jaw broken. because he was trying to break up a fight between a black guy and a white guy, both from B Company, who were drunk and fighting each other and shouting racial epithets at each other. He tried to break him up, both of them hit him, and one of them broke his jaw.
Wow.
Just a little anecdotal thing.
But in your company, you didn't have any problems.
Yeah, we didn't have any problems at all. Tucker, a guy named Tucker, and Chunky. Chunky, I have no idea his name. One of my most favorite human beings I've ever known. I love Chunky. He was a 19 and then 20-year-old best chess player I've ever seen.
Chunky.
Chunky was his nickname, and I have no idea what his real name is. From Cincinnati, Ohio, and he was kind of a very, very intelligent but unlettered guy that, like I say, is the best chess player I've ever seen. He beat everybody in the company. He learned to play chess when he was in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah, and picked it up and just was good at it. We had a guy, Catherine, from Philadelphia, who loved jazz, and Bobby Troup was his hero. He was a black guy, and then we had a guy from Mississippi, a guy named Tucker, and Tucker just about got along with everybody. Tucker had a kind of a, how to say this, a way of rebelling against the system. It wasn't a big rebellion, it was a little rebellion. He had a little goatee right under his lower lip, and which was against regulations, but for some reason nobody ever noticed. And I think he always hoped somebody would. But those are my buddies. You know, those are some of my better friends right there.
Have you kept in touch with them at all?
Not really. I haven't even kept in touch with very well with Krieger. I've lost Krieger somewhere. I don't even know where he is. I keep doing internet searches, try to find some of those guys. My problem is I don't know their names now.
Right.
Soon after I got back, I had an address book and I lost it. Mm-hmm. And it may still be somewhere, but I haven't found it. And that's one of the great tragedies of my life, is losing that address book, because I wanted to keep track of everybody, but I didn't. I know.
Okay. Did you see any alcohol abuse or drug abuse?
In my company in 1969, we didn't have drug abuse very much. We had about four or five guys, maybe maximum five or six, maybe six, that were the druggies, and the rest of us really avoided them in my platoon, my company.
Okay.
Not platoon, just company.
Okay.
I was friends with them, but I was never one of them. I was trying to be friends with everybody, frankly. But they kind of stayed to themselves, and they didn't have security clearances, and they were the ones who, because that they were known drug abusers, and one of them actually spent about 6 months hard time over at Long Bend Jail for drug abuse.
They didn't get their security clearances because they were known drug abusers.
They lost their security clearances, and so they couldn't be in comm centers. So what they were, they filled sandbags and repaired bunkers and built bunkers. In fact, we had a concrete bunker after a while they built. But we had a little bit of alcoholism. We had a guy from North Carolina who was, I didn't realize it at the time. Later on, I realized the guy was rip roaring, you know, fall down the gutter drunk. He really was. Some of the orders I've got has his name on there, and otherwise I couldn't remember his name. But we had a lot of drinkers. We didn't have too many that really abused it very much. I abused it twice, as I discussed a while ago, the first time I got there, and then right before I came home. The guys decided they were going to get the old teacher drunk, and they did, and didn't take them long to do it either. By the way, because I had been a teacher and I was a little bit older, the guys didn't expect me to do the gin and sin bet with them, you know. I wasn't expected to go to the prostitutes. I wasn't expected to be, drink a lot. They expected me to be a good guy. That first day off I alluded to a while ago, I went with our motor messengers. About three or four times a week we had motor messengers that drove into MACV headquarters in Saigon. They were always wanting somebody to ride shotgun with them. They had the driver and the assistant driver who was a gunner, and they always wanted one or two other guys to go along that could get off and go as a kind of casual shotgun, you know, mm-hmm. to man the M60 machine gun, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a friend of mine and I decided we were going to go into Saigon. We wanted to do some sightseeing. We wanted to see the big city. Mm-hmm. And so we went into Saigon. Well, they took us on a tour. We got to go to MACV headquarters, and they had even flush toilets and air conditioning. That was fabulous stuff in there. It was sort of civilized. It was clean. Mm-hmm. People were walking around with freshly pressed uniforms, you know, and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It was like the country boys coming in. We got to go to Cholon and Tudo Street, mm-hmm. and they dropped us off. They took us to a bar. And the guys were good guys. They didn't drink. They just went and had a Coke. You know, it was kind of a stop before they went back to base camp, back to our 2nd Field Force base camp. We got in there, and there were some prostitutes in there in the bar. And one of the prostitutes came over and sat down on my lap, and one of the other guys said, "Leave Bussy alone. He's a married man." And she said, "Oh, okay." And she quit talking amorously to me and started discussing. Ho Chi Minh had just died recently, and she started discussing in broken English the concept of Ho Chi Minh going to hell.
Is this the Ho Chi Minh story?
This is the Ho Chi Minh story. and so I always tell about the Saigon prostitute, and I had a discussion. a great philosophical debate on Ho Chi Minh going to hell.
Did she think he was going?
She thought he was going to hell.
Did you think he was going?
I didn't have any idea. I suspect that time his mother didn't think that he was going to hell if she had been alive. But I went along with her in the uh-huh. discussion.
Uh-huh. What were your impressions of Saigon?
I was excited. Saigon was a wonderful city. You know, I was there, let's see, then, and I think one or two other times. I went through there on R&R when mm-hmm. I left Tonsonute Air Base mm-hmm. To Japan. Mm-hmm. And I loved every minute I was in Saigon. I thought it was an exciting city. It was... beautiful architecture. Mm-hmm. The people were basically friendly, mm-hmm. Happy people. This is a superficial sort of thing, you know, impression I got. But I really think there's some accuracy, some validity to mm-hmm. it. But I loved it every time. I wish I could have been there a lot more.
Okay.
And someday I'm hoping to go back, frankly. Okay. And I want to go back and mainly want to go to Saigon. And I'd like to go to that whole area around there someday. But mm-hmm. the really, main thing I want to do is go back to Saigon. I want to see what it looks like now. Mm-hmm. Someday I'm going to, I think.
Did a lot of people partake in the prostitution?
Yeah. Almost everybody did except me. Really? Yeah. Okay. Almost sure, to some degree or another.
So would they come to the base, or did you have to go off base?
You had to go off base.
Okay.
Had to go off base. Now, once in a while, somebody would sneak in, a prostitute. If they got caught, they were in extremely bad trouble, but all of us were aware that was happening.
Right.
And once in a while there would be, and Vietnamese were not authorized to be out there after dark. Indigenous people weren't, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you think of the Vietnamese civilians?
In the area where I was, frankly, I like the Vietnamese civilians a lot. They were, what I've heard about, you know, the southern Vietnamese, mm-hmm. about being laid back, relaxed, happy, mm-hmm. That's the impression I had of the civilians in the area where I was.
Okay.
And I liked them a lot. I thought they were basically honest people. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying all this, and I'm sure there were some Viet Cong on our base camp. I'm sure there's some Viet Cong and those people that were being very friendly to me. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I really, really do believe that they were being honestly friendly to us. Okay. And there were some Catholics in the area that had a tendency, I think, to be somewhat anti-communist, you know, mm-hmm. if not very anti-communist mm-hmm. in the area. At least that's the impression I got.
Okay. Your R&R, you went to Japan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Well, I wasn't going to go on R&R. I was sending all my money home to my wife. Mm-hmm. And Krieger was, too. He was sending it home. He wanted to have a sports car.
Okay.
He got back home. That was his main... And ultimately, he did get a sports car.
Uh-huh.
And I was sending all my money home to my wife so that we could, you know, buy stuff mm-hmm. for when I got out of the Army, we'd be able to set up a household again. Mm-hmm. So I was going to go. But towards the end, by December, Krieger and I both getting real cranky. And I was. Everybody else had been on R&R, and we hadn't, and we were really getting what you might say now jinky.
Uh-huh.
And people started noticing we were getting cranky and hard to get along with. Everybody
jinky.
What I would call jinky right now, hard to get along with,
okay.
and grouchy, and
maybe not always as coherent as one would think we should be. So we needed a break, is what it was. So Krieger went to the first sergeant and asked the first sergeant if he could go on R&R and something or other. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to get to go to Japan because that was the least popular of the R&R sites.
Okay.
And that would fit my purposes entirely because it was cheap. You didn't have to have $1,200 or something.
Right.
I took a whole $100 with me and brought about 70 back, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Believe it or not. I was an old married man, and I didn't want to go for the gin and sin like everybody else does mm-hmm. when you go to Bangkok or someplace mm-hmm. or Sydney. Mm-hmm. One of my good friends, Surfer Boy, by the way, I can digress and go off on Surfer Boy for half an hour, mm-hmm. Went to Sydney. Anyway, so I decided, hey, Krieger got R&R to Camp Zama, Japan. So I went and talked to the first sergeant, and he said, yeah. And next day, he had orders cut for us for R&R. He could get us in that quickly.
Wow.
And less than a week later, I think, it's December the 8th, 69, and went on R&R until the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And we was driven down to Tansanut to the air base down there. Now, I don't remember. We spent less than a day there. Bumped into a friend of mine that I had been to basic training with who had been at Hamburger Hill, by the way. They'd been wounded at Hamburger Hill and was going on the second R&R. Yeah. Left Tansanut Air Base and flew to Yokota Air Base. Was that it? Yokota?
Yokota.
I think.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yokota Air Base, and we landed there and were driven in the middle of the night to Tokyo to the R&R center there
mm-hmm.
and briefed and then went and took our showers and we went to ready clothes. We took our showers and signed up for tours. I wasn't going to do any of that. I was going to sleep.
Uh-huh.
Well, I ended up going on every day. I was going on some tour someplace.
Uh-huh.
And that tour, that first day, was into Tokyo itself. And it was sukiyaki in a stage production. And, golly, I don't remember. Some other things that we did around Tokyo, which was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Hakone National Forest. We went to Mount Fuji. Did another tour of Tokyo, including the outside of the Emperor's Palace, that area in there. Mm-hmm. I had one of the best times I've ever had in my life.
Were you able to contact your wife?
I wasn't able to then. Some of the guys said that they tried to make calls from there, but I never could, I couldn't get through there that way.
Okay. Were you in civilian clothes?
We were in civilian clothes. We weren't allowed to wear uniforms off post.
Okay.
And actually, we wore civilian clothes on post too.
Mm-hmm.
And at nighttime, if we weren't on a tour and having dinner on the economy, we went to there's a really fancy, nice NCO club
mm-hmm.
there, and we'd go have dinner there. And they always had a stage show there too,
okay.
in the club itself.
You said you went home on emergency leave.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
I was in the comm center one morning. This is, I think, a Sunday morning, circa 18th of January, 16th, 18th of January. I've got order somewhere. February. It was if we could find out. It was the day after. I know I had guard duty the night before, and mm-hmm. it was the first day of Tet of 69.
Okay.
Whenever that would have been. Anyway, the next day I went to work. I didn't had guard duty, but still had to go to work at that time. No matter what happened, you had to go to work the next day. So I went to work. And the CO called and sent that set for me. I went down, reported into the CO, and he told me that my wife had had a stillbirth. Our first child was stillborn at term, and more than likely she's dead. My wife's dead. This captain was a very direct person. he was an old-time NCO that had gotten, he was a captain now.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed in the direct approach, and he said it that way, and it's one of those things, it hit me like a ton of bricks, frankly.
Right.
Guy took me over to 90th Replacement Battalion, and I was among 10 people who were on emergency leave, who was put immediately assigned to a plane, and went on a plane that afternoon. This is morning and that afternoon. And flew from Benoit Air Base to Okinawa. I've forgotten the air base there. Okinawa to Anchorage, Alaska. Across Anchorage to McGuire Air Force, New Jersey, right next to Fort Dix, by the way. and went through overseas replacement Fort Dix. That's where I sneaked in those boots, by the way, I showed you a while ago.
Okay.
That's where I smuggled them in, actually.
Oh, yeah?
That was illegal. I could have gotten in bad trouble mm-hmm. with that uniform and the boots and everything. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing it sneaking in. I just wanted to have some foot gear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just left them there after I sneaked them in. And they at Fort Dix, it was in the morning, and when we landed at McGuire Air Force Base, it was at about 2 or 3 feet of snow.
Mm-hmm.
The airplane had trouble landing, mm-hmm. and it scared the hound out of us. It kind of snapped me out. I was going through periods of sitting in my chair, worried about my wife, or with a blanket over my head, crying, frankly, because I just knew that she had died in childbirth. Well, I got to overseas replacement there at Fort Dix, and they checked us out, got our uniforms, and didn't give us time to call. They shipped us out. They tried to get those on emergency leave. There were about 10 of us out as quickly as possible. They sent us over to the airport over at Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
and there one of the guys on emergency leave was an older Spec 6 medic. He was a black guy who kind of took me. He noticed I was having trouble. I was really having a lot of trouble. He kind of took me under his wing and kind of helped me get through.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having trouble calling because I wasn't sure if I could do it. And he nearly forced me to call. In fact, he dialed the number for me.
Mm-hmm.
Called my dad and asked how Sharon was. And Dad told me, you know, I'm having trouble right now, you know, holding back tear stuff. Dad told me she was okay. And I heard him come home. And we had trouble getting out, and it took me a couple of days to get home because of the bad weather and delayed flights. To make a long story short, they routed us from Philadelphia to Atlanta, I think, and then New Orleans, and then finally into Dallas, and then from Dallas into Lubbock. And I got home in time for the funeral. Initially, I was for a 30-day leave just to be with Sharon,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we had the funeral the day that I got in, and Sharon was still in the hospital, and she was still a little too ill to go to the funeral, and I went to the funeral, and my folks were there, and her folks, and a few relatives, and I still go by and visit that gravesite sometime.
Did she know you were coming in?
She didn't till Dad had called her. I called my dad, and
right,
Dad had called Sharon and told her I was coming in.
Okay.
And by the way, I hadn't had a shower since that when I was in Vietnam the night before. Right after guard duty, I went and took a shower before I went to work. And Sharon had some kind of cologne or something in there, and she sprayed it over. I got this when she was in the hospital. They rolled in a little bunk bed, and I slept there.
Mm-hmm.
And she sprayed the area, guys. Smelling bad. I've wondered over the years, you know, what I must have smelled like in that uh-huh. those airports and everything coming in.
Uh-huh.
I was home for 30 days, and the doctor suggested that I might want to stay a little bit longer, so he contacted the Red Cross. The Red Cross contacted my unit, and the CO gave me permission to stay a couple more weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was home about 6 weeks, and there's another story here. Since I came in through Fort Dix Overseas Replacement, which is very unusual,
mm-hmm.
one usually came in through Travis Air Force Base, you know, in mm-hmm. Oakland and you know, or Fort Lewis, Washington or so. Mm-hmm. Well, I came in through Fort Dix Overseas Replacement. Well, I thought you had to go back that way.
Right.
And so I went back to Fort Dix, and we were at Fort Dix was mostly an overseas replacement station for Europe, not mm-hmm. for Vietnam or for Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think even one for Korea was there like Fort Lewis. Anyway, we were there at Fort Dix for 5 days, and it was an abjectly miserable time. If I hadn't brought some books and somebody had a radio, I'd have gone nuts. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
We were there just languishing,
mm-hmm.
Waiting for our plane. We got our flight out, and the flight was, instead of going back the way we had come through Anchorage, Alaska, and back that way, went across the continental United States to Oakland. Well, we started realizing during this flight that we were having a little bit of engine trouble. Landed at Oakland, and we stayed there an hour, hour and a half. And then we took off, went to Honolulu, stayed there an hour and a half or 2 hours. When we took off from Oakland, we circled San Francisco Bay and the bridge. It was wonderful tourist thing to do,
mm-hmm.
but it was kind of scary because you could hear that engine gaining power and then losing power and then gaining power. I don't know why it kept going with us. I've never figured that out. rather than taking about 21 hours, which was the normal flight time, this took 35 hours all total. We went to Honolulu, Guam, and I've forgotten. And then back into Benoit Air Base. Mm-hmm. But that was the longest flight I've ever heard of from the continental.
Very long flight.
Yes, sir.
Very long flight.
And it's difficult to fly as I've ever had. I got airsick one time, mm-hmm. you know, and I love flying across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love that. I love to see the islands, you know. I love to. Mm-hmm. I love to see ships down below and the whole thing. Well, I didn't enjoy that flight very much. Anyway,
you got back in.
And I called my unit. The clerk there at Overseas Replacement was like most clerks at the time. Mm-hmm. He was not a people person. Mm-hmm. He was rude and hard to get along with. Anyway, he let me have the phone, and I called my unit. Mm-hmm. And the guy there was that clerk I was talking about, company clerk. He was a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. He said, "We'll be over there." And I thought, "He's coming over." So he and a couple, and the Jeep driver and another guy came over just to see me. Mm-hmm. He said, "Bussy, I've got good news and bad news." The good news is you've been promoted to Spec 4. The bad news is that since you've been AWOL, you've got an Article 15 and you've been busted back to A3. I said, "I wasn't AWOL." Here's my orders. And he got back and he talked first started to talk to the CEO and got that straightened out. But they'd already already demoted me. They promoted me in March, and in April I got demoted again. I was promoted when I was gone. But that was good news and bad news. He picked me up, and from then on I just kind of stayed there. But mm-hmm. I didn't really pull a whole year tour. It was there was six weeks of stateside.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a couple questions. Did you ever see any wild animals or anything?
Well, we had the normal, you know, like insects that people hate, you know, and we had things like scorpions and that sort of thing. We always heard rumors about things like tigers mm-hmm. in the area. I don't know if they were tigers in that area or not. No tiger in his right mind would be quite in that area. There were monkeys all over the place. There were snakes, and theoretically poison snakes in the area.
Did you see
them? I didn't. I saw monkeys a lot.
Okay.
I saw scorpions and I saw the large cockroaches. But I didn't see. I don't know if I saw a poison snake or not. I don't remember seeing a poison. Something that I would. I don't know. I don't remember seeing a snake personally. See, the other guys always said they talked about it. We were supposed to empty our boots out, you know, in the morning from mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Worried about scorpions and snakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I knew of during the night was we always had rats in the hooch, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Guys would leave food items on the floor and the rats would come in and get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see, I don't remember seeing anything but those sorts of things.
Looking back at your tour there, what was the most memorable thing?
Yeah, there's so much. It's really hard for me. Sometimes I've thought about that very thing mm-hmm. and I'm not really sure. There's so much. It was a most significant point in my life. I'm better for having done it.
Mm-hmm.
This being promoted to sergeant, believe it or not, was extremely important. I haven't had that thrill even when I got a master's degree.
Really?
For something that's like that's happened to me.
Why was that?
I never expected it to happen. Mm-hmm. It was somewhat of a surprise that I made sergeant, and it's something I really wanted, and most of the guys really wanted to make sergeant before they came home,
mm-hmm.
and that was really significant to me.
Mm-hmm.
I got an Army Commendation Medal, and that was really pretty neat at the time, and that was a significant medal at the time for us.
Mm-hmm.
In Signal Corps, this is another Signal Corps attitude. We always thought if you got a Bronze Star, if it had been anything else, if it had been combat arms, you'd have gotten a Silver Star.
Mm-hmm.
If you got an Army Commendation, ARCOM, it was equivalent to a Bronze Star for someone else. So ARCOM was important to us, and mm-hmm. I was able to get an ARCOM there, and that was very significant.
Okay.
I did. The other guys, except for two of us, knew that we were going to be decorated the day that I got it. And the assistant platoon sergeant, who was supposed to notify everybody and got everybody kind of in a pretty good, the best uniform they could have, dressed up for the ceremony. Well, I didn't know. He didn't know till we got a call saying, "Where's Bussy? Where's this other guy? Where are they? They're supposed to be down here." So I got down there, and they and I got in the came in the orderly room, and the CO said, "Sergeant Bussy, how long have you known about this?" I said, "Oh, about 10 minutes, sir." He said, "That's what I thought." And he was mad. He was always mad about something anyway. Mm-hmm. Except for me, he loved me. He thought I was wonderful. He told me one time, "He's finally glad to see a good soldier." That was really big for me. That old fat boy that was in basic training, that's really sounded good. Anyway, and I got decorated, and I had the office looking uniform. Boots were ugly. I showed you that little picture out there. Mm-hmm. That uniform was really in bad shape that I was in. You can't tell by the picture, but I didn't really look very good. Mm-hmm. In that, in fact, those boots could have done had a whole lot more work to them than that. But the battalion commander presented to us, that's his picture, that guy that has the Tropic Lightning combat patch on. He was that battalion commander I was talking to you about. That was such a good guy. Okay. And he was very complimentary to me. Mm-hmm. Like one of the older soldiers said earlier, E7 said, he thought that's probably the first time he's seen a real soldier get a award like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the other guys who worked on the uniforms, I hadn't, of course.
How long, when you made sergeant, how long before you left?
I made sergeant in November and I left in January. Okay. I was up. I found out I was up for promotion in October, but I hadn't been in the Army long enough.
Okay.
And I had to wait another month before I got promoted and I finally promoted. That was a significant thing for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was still proud of it, actually. Mm-hmm.
How did you find out you were leaving? You knew your days?
Everyone there knew exactly how many days they had. It was always something like, how much time do you have? Oh, 30 days to wake up. It was always that cliche sort of thing, 30 days or 15 days to wake up or 120 days to wake up. Mm-hmm. Most of the guys had what they call short-timer calendars,
right. Which
was usually a picture of a naked woman drawn with divided into 365 parts, and you colored in the parts.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a short-timer calendar. By the way, I don't know if you'd want this sort of thing. I have two calendars. The only calendars you could get at that time and where I was in Vietnam, and I always put that disclaimer on there, were some Playboy calendars. I have a 1969 Playboy, kept two of them, desk calendars. I have two of those I brought home. That's the only calendar I have.
Sure, we'll take them.
I'd least like to bring one or two of them to you. My daughter discovered that the other day. My wife had to explain to her that's the only calendar your old man could get in Vietnam. But my daughter, excuse me, was looking at some of my pics not too long ago when she found that, and she was a little bit upset about it, I think, until her mother explained to her what happened.
How'd you feel leaving Vietnam?
I was happier than a human being could possibly be. I never will forget. We had 5 days to what we call clear post, and we had to be debriefed and from the comm center and sign a paper that we weren't going to divulge any of the classified information and all that sort of thing. And we had to clear finance and admin. We had to clear supply and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, we were given 5 days, which turned out to be about 3.5. And those are 3.5 to 5 days of the most happy moments of my life, actually. And I never will forget the special feeling I had for that. And then I never will forget being in the airplane. I got a window seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking out the window and seeing the jungle as we were taking off from Biwa Air Base. And we'd take off at a real steep angle. Mm-hmm. And I was leaning back and looking over there, and I thought, oh, thank God I'm away from here. and I don't know why, but we were low enough where I could see when we flew over the coast of the South China Sea, I could see that. I said, there it's gone, you know. I started feeling really good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a happy trip home.
Really?
The other trip I had when I wanted emergency leave was the most miserable thing nearly I've ever had in my life. But that was really significant.
Quite a contrast.
Oh, yes. Enormous contrast, obviously.
How did you adjust when you got back stateside?
I adjusted well. Some of the guys didn't. I adjusted really well. One of the guys I came home with was a guy from Alabama. His name was Baker. He was with the 199th Light Infantry Brigade. And he and I knew each, known each other in AIT. Mm-hmm. And I just bumped into Baker on the way home. You know, and I talked to him on the phone and kind of kept track of him. I hadn't seen him. He and his buddy, we came home together, and Baker and I actually flew from Oakland, from San Francisco rather, down to Dallas together. I flew back to Lubbock. He flew on to Mobile, Alabama. Mm-hmm. Well, Baker was an old, rough, tough Southern boy who didn't take anything from anybody, some sort of guy. Well, we got in the airport there at San Francisco, and it was a classic scene. The 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was. The soldiers, obviously from Vietnam, they had the medals and all the stuff on their uniforms, and the hippies that they didn't say anything to us, but they act like they were coming close to saying something. And Baker was primed and ready for them. I got a little bit of that when I came home. I had a few bad dreams. We had a lot of incoming. For the last 4 or 5 months I was in Vietnam on our base camp. We had
rocket attacks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. mostly rocket attacks. Mm-hmm. And I used to have bad dreams about those a lot. Mm-hmm. But I just dozed. It didn't take me long to get over it. I wasn't one of those real heavy duty combat veterans that mm-hmm. Still carry it with me. Mm-hmm. but I adjusted well. I'm not sure what to say. There's so many things that were easy for me, but are still hard sometimes. Sometimes some of the attitudes of people still bother me,
Such as?
It's the common thing I'm sure you've heard billions of times now. People assuming because you're a Vietnam veteran that you were a baby-killing drugger,
Right.
I still get that. I had a principal, after I came back home, after I was out of the Army, I was had a principal that asked me, and I thought he knew me better than this, asked me, what was it like to, I forgot what drug he mentioned, heroin or something, what was it like to do that? He assumed because as a veteran. That I was been a druggie. I've never been a drugger in my life. Mm-hmm. And I was very angry with him and told him I was angry. But you would get that sometime. When I worked on my master's degree, there was a little bit of animosity for undergraduates toward veterans mm-hmm. when I was working on my master's. Most of the graduate students didn't feel that way. At least they didn't let me know that they felt that way. Sometimes mm-hmm. one wonders. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, one would bump into another veteran, and would, hey, welcome home, brother, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But over the years, there has been some things. It's gotten to the point, where I think I am like a lot of veterans. I sometimes don't trust other people in their attitudes when they find out I'm a veteran. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite people, who was one of my fellow teachers that I really respected, said, whom I had known for about 3 or 4 years, found out I was a Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. He said, "I didn't know you were. I thought you were such a nice guy. You couldn't be a Vietnam veteran." Mm-hmm. And that was staggering. Mm-hmm. that was nearly overwhelming. How could someone think that? Mm-hmm. Have that kind of presupposition, mm-hmm. that bigotry. Think that I had a superintendent that I felt like killing one time. In 1991, the summer, my daughter, who was a sophomore in high school, she and some friends, she and some classmates, got relatives who had been Korean veterans, Vietnam veterans, World War II veterans, and one veteran from the Gulf War who had come home mm-hmm. To ride in a parade there in Petersburg. There's a place called, a time called Petersburg Day. It's August. Mm-hmm. And I rode on one of in the parade and waved and that sort of thing. I was the only Vietnam veteran there. Well, that afternoon, this superintendent, whom I lost all respect for, said something to the effect that how can Vietnam veterans do something like that, ride in a parade and feel good about themselves when they lost the war? And I tried to explain to him, and I'm trying not to use filthy expletives, which I did use in front of him, mm-hmm. That we didn't lose the war. I was a soldier in the Army, and we did lose the war. Our part of the war, we actually, I think, won. Yeah, that's neither here nor there, but that sort of attitude, once in a while you still get that, son.
We had a person in Lubbock, I think in the late 80s, obviously psychotic person who killed his social worker and a policeman. Mm-hmm. One of the radio announcers, my wife heard on the radio, one of the radio announcers assumed that he must be a Vietnam veteran because he had gone crazy and started shooting people. I used to get that stuff all the time. Nothing even used to make me madder than that. And I'm like, you know, oh, I'm sure you've heard these stories a billion times, the same sort of thing. I've had all those experiences with those things. The poor that concept.
Yeah.
People having these silly presuppositions about us. I firmly believe that the people that I served with, in the era that I served, mm-hmm. were as fine an example of American youth as there is anywhere. Okay. I really do.
Okay.
And that's just my experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a good friend who's a Vietnam veteran who at one time taught with me. Mm-hmm. He was in the, I've forgotten the division he was in. He was an infantryman in 72. Mm-hmm. By that time, apparently the discipline and the drug problem, the discipline had broken down, the drug problem was getting severe. He was the only one in his company who wasn't a drugger.
Wow.
The only one. Mm-hmm. He'd been raised in a very strict, he's Puerto Rican. Raised as in a very strict environment back home, he didn't do anything like that. But his friends did, and I don't think he was lying. I think it's probably true.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel in April 1975 when the country fell?
Extremely sad. It's really hard to describe.
Mm-hmm.
So much has been lost. Mm-hmm. In that time, I thought so much had been lost for nothing sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I still feel that way. However, I'm not sure. It's really too early in history, I think, to determine some of the questions that we have about the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, a lot of it's 25, 30 years down the line between 25 and 30 years. That's still too early. Did we lose the war? I don't know. I don't know if history's going to determine that eventually or not. You know, it's still early to know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, maybe I'm rationalizing, you know, but I still really feel really strongly that's true.
What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned from the war?
Well, I think one of the lessons we learned was exemplified by the war we had in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
To get the support of the people, to support Congress, mm-hmm. To have an overwhelming force, to have a concrete goal,
mm-hmm.
and to expedite it as efficiently as possible, mm-hmm. and accomplish the goal as quickly and as expeditiously as possible, mm-hmm. with as much force as necessary.
And that was our mistake in Vietnam.
For me, that was our mistake. Among some other mistakes, that was our mistake. I think, sometimes I think that if we had had, I still cling to the idea that the Vietnamization concept was a good concept, and I wish that we had started earlier and had maybe make it more concerted effort to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying all these things, and I'm really not sure. I'm not enough of an expert to really know, but that's just the feeling, the impression I have, I guess, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think that all those things are still a toss-up. Maybe history will bear them out, maybe it won't.
Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in America?
A little bit now and again. My daughter, when I was at Fort Detrick, a couple of my friends had married Vietnamese women and brought them home, mm-hmm. and had some contact with them there. Mm-hmm. And then my sister at Hell Center, there was a doctor for a while, a Vietnamese family,
mm-hmm.
who lived in Hell Center. Doctor in Hell Center was a... I think three or four children, and my sister taught all three or four of them. I don't remember where they were, and I met them a lot, and I actually talked to the doctor. In fact, he was my family physician for a while, and it was Dr. Nguyen.
Okay. Looking back at your experience in Vietnam today, uh-huh. what do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while there?
There are so many things that I learned. It's really hard to pin something down, and I've never been asked it quite that way. I think probably
I've always been a person who's been accepting of other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even more so, I'm accepting of the Vietnamese people that I met there. I'm not talking about the enemy or other soldiers or something like that, but the common indigenous people to Vietnam. I have had a very good feeling, very good thoughts about them. Warm memories sometimes. For example, there was a young girl who found out a couple of us were getting ready to go home.
Mm-hmm.
She fixed us a meal.
Mm.
All it was something like what you might call ramen noodles, that sort of thing.
Right.
It was basically it, you know, and we were always apprehensive about eating there, but we knew that it was a very bad insult not to, and ate it. It was enjoyed it, didn't hurt me or anything else,
mm-hmm.
and that was significant to me that that she thought enough of us to do that,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it was very touching,
mm-hmm.
And that was significant to me. And I don't know, there's so many things. I found out I could be brave. I found out I could form a friendship, a camaraderie with people that was unlike any other kind of camaraderie that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
Deep brotherly love for you know those guys,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, you know, I really don't remember many of the names, but I remember their nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have very good memories of things that they said and did, but for the life of me, I cannot remember their names.
So how do you feel about your service, personally?
I'm very proud of it, which has been helped. My family has always been proud that I was a soldier and a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Both my children are very proud. My daughter, when she found out I was going to do this,
mm-hmm.
she lives in Columbus, she broke down and cried.
Really?
Can I express it?
What?
And she's a very articulate person. My son doesn't say much. He just pats me on the back. And when we've gone to see the traveling wall,
mm-hmm.
I've seen it about three times.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those that goes with me with his arm around me. Yeah. My daughter, verbally, gives me very positive feedback about things like this and support. And when she knew I was going to do this,
mm-hmm.
she broke down and cried.
Mm-hmm.
Expressed pride in me for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Which may not mean a lot to most people, but it does to me. But I've got support from my family, and I'm very proud of my service. And I'd go do it again.
Tell me about your experiences at the wall. You said, have you been to Washington to see the main wall?
I haven't been back to Washington since 1970, okay. You know, since the wall.
How about the traveling wall?
I've been to the traveling wall twice in Lubbock and once in Plainview.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very solemn, very poignant moments for me. I'm very reluctant to leave it. I get there and I just want to stay there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's symbol of so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm you know, it's always, and it's over, I think I've said this before, it's overused there in a catharsis, that if you have to use that cliche of catharsis, that's an appropriate thing to use it for, you know, because it really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's something physical that is symbolic of healing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, at least, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I feel better about my countrymen and their attitude towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some complex emotions I don't even know how to articulate. You know? I don't know how to explain. I'm not articulate enough to do it.
If you walked into a high school or college classroom today and you had to tell young people about Vietnam and the Vietnam War, what would you tell them?
Well, I tell them all kinds of things. I do that quite a bit since I'm an educator. I've done it at least a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
every year, which is I thought it was kind of ironic the first time I did it, because I remember when I was a teacher and the war first started, I had a person who had just come back from Vietnam come into my class and talk about Vietnam. He was a Marine up in the north, up in the Da Nang area. And he was one of my wife's former boyfriends. I found out later, just before I knew her. But I've done it very frequently, and basically I tell them basically what the war was about. Basically what went on. I tried to spill some of the myths that commonly you see about the war. I tried to explain that Vietnam veterans aren't the baby-killing druggers, the homeless people, the bums out on the street, that they are basically upright, decent people by and large. And I tried to explain to them, that something that I mentioned to you a while ago, that they were extremely good examples of American youth. The veterans, and that's the approach that I take with them. And most of the time, they are very supportive and very interested in that sort of thing. You always have someone, not so much now, but in the past, that wanted to hear the shooting and killing and blood and gut stuff. And I don't, of course, do that sort of thing. And I tell them that's really bad manners to ask anyone, if they kill people and how many they've killed and some of those sorts of things. And I tell them, let's don't do that. Let's don't go that direction. But basically, that's the approach I take. Is I try to dispel the myths while explaining the basic concept of how we got into the war and how we got out of the war, and some of the things that went on in the war, and try to tell them a little bit about Theta 68. And basically, that's it.
Okay. Any songs take you back to Vietnam?
Oh yeah, that was on that. There's so many things. For example, I always get all teary-eyed leaving on a jet plane. That song is very, very good memories about that. I was a married man, and I always think of my wife. Abraham, Martin, and John. Very popular when I first got there, and that didn't have anything to do with the war particularly, but I was a very idealistic person at that time. Still, I was 26 years old when that was very popular, maybe 27, and I always felt an affinity with that song. And then we had a whole bunch of songs at that time that dealt with home. For example, there was Galveston. Can't think of the artist. Oh golly, he's from Arkansas.
Country singer.
Yeah, I can't think of his name. Anyway, and there was a song that I've never even heard since then. It's called Seattle. There was a television show that I never did get to see. It was on television called Seattle. And there was a song, and I could almost sing it if I were brave enough to try to sing. But any songs dealing with home and going on trains or planes or things like that, I detested at the time the song Cloud Nine. I don't know if you've ever heard it. That was very popular among the black guys in our unit and among most of the guys in our unit, except I hated it because I thought it was a drug song. I think it was. It still is. Still like drugs. I love that song. I really do. It's one of my favorite songs. One of my favorite songs at the time was Soul Man. I love Soul Man.
Oh, yeah.
I think I told you in the paper that I filled out about Chunky?
Refresh my memory.
Okay, Chunky.
I do remember, but I want to.
Okay, Chunky. We went on red alert one night. We had some incoming rounds and went on red alert. Somewhere we lost Chunky. Didn't know where he was. I was a sergeant at that time. And one of my jobs on that red alert, the CO told me to go around and see if we could find anybody and get him up on the line or get him out of the reactionary force. And I looked for Chunky. He wasn't anywhere we could find. We couldn't find Chunky. Chunky appeared not too long after. About 4 o'clock in the morning, we went off red alert. We went back. The guys broke out soft drinks and beer and things like cheese and sausage. One of the guys was from Wisconsin and used to get care packs of all that stuff in it. So he broke out that stuff, started eating. Well, Chunky appears. He has a helmet on backwards. He's in his underwear. He has both boots are on the wrong feet. Somebody got his feet in his boots that way. He's drunk. He did have his weapon. I don't think he had his flak jacket. I remember he had his protective mask on. Oh, golly, there's something else about him I forgot. Anyway, he came in. He wasn't sure where he had been, but we determined that he had been out with B Company on their perimeter line. And Lord, how they... And like I say, he didn't have a t-shirt. He had his underwear on, thank goodness, at least that. He didn't even have a t-shirt on.
That's
But Chunky had gone on out on red alert out on the perimeter line drunk, and that's how he appeared when he got out there.
Probably would have scared the NCO.
Exactly. He was the one that went on the line right after that. Talking about the song Soul Man.
Mm-hmm.
Tucker was on guard duty, and Chunky and Tucker were very close. They were like brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And Chunky had gotten drunk and went up and started singing Soul Man out on the perimeter line. And Tucker told him, get the hell away from here. If you don't quit singing Soul Man, you're going to be a dead man. So Chunky got out of there. He had to have been there.
Do you think of Chunky when you hear Soul Man?
I sure do, every time. I always think of Chunky. In fact, I heard it several days ago and thought of Chunky.
Yeah.
I think of Chunky a lot, actually.
Yeah. What do you think of the movies that have come out of Vietnam?
I don't like hardly any of them at all.
Yeah.
We Were Soldiers,
uh-huh.
I like it. I like the Vietnam part of Forrest Gump, but that's really about it. I don't like any of the others. I think they have some stereotypical things. I think they're inaccurate, or that are detrimental to the image of people who have served in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you hear that from us, but that's basically the way I feel about it.
Okay.
I read We Were Soldiers Once and Young before it became popular, actually, a long time ago. And I was delighted to see it made into a movie. And, get the acclaim that it apparently has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's the only one I really, really like. You know, I detest Platoon. I detest Full Metal Jacket. I love those two movies, by the way. And most of the others I do, too.
Okay.
I'm sorry to be so vehement, but I really...
No, that's very helpful. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add or say?
Well, there's so much, but I can't think of anything right now. There are billions of other things I guess I could say.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we really, for as far as I know, covered, I guess, basically most of it.
Okay.
I really can't think of anything. But then I just appreciate enormously this opportunity to express myself. But I mostly appreciate what you and the others are doing here. I think that's a noble undertaking. And I'm not using that I'm not using hyperbole. I really believe that.
Thank you.
I'm not exaggerating a bit.
Thank you very much.
It's something which is... It's vital, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And just on behalf of me, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Really a great deal.
All right. Well, we'll end up our interview now.
Okay.
With Mr. Bussey, it is November 11th, a little after 5 p.m. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.